sports information you can't live without is right here on Sportsnet Today. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Today in the Sportsnet Radio Network. Good Saturday afternoon, everybody. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you until 8 o'clock Eastern Time, at which time we'll take you to the two best words in sports. You know what the two best words in sports are? Game 7. Really? Best of 7, Game 7. Sudden death is great, too. But after 7 games of knock 'em down, drag 'em out, here we go in the National League, the American League Championship Series and the National League Championship Series, both coming up later, Game 7 and 6, actually, on the way. Baseball will be a big focus on the show. The Leaf signings, of course, with Joe Thornton. You can reach Josh at jgoldberg12 on Twitter, at jgoldberg12. I'm at the Raj 590, and you can always text the show 590, 590. Name and location, please, if you are texting. Josh, Game 7 is the two best words in sports, and this is only the second time in history of baseball, at least, where we've seen a Game 7 series go 3-0-0-3. So what happens in Game 7 this time?
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating because the whole series has been fascinating. You know, you look at the first three games, and okay, Tampa Bay deserved to win all of those games, but they were all pretty close. And you know, if Altuve plays a little bit better defensively, as he has his entire career, and doesn't make those couple of bad throws and lead to some runs, then you know, this series might already be over for Houston. But you know, I just look at this whole series; it's a really fascinating kind of contrast between, say what you want about the Astros and the cheating. They did it. There's no question about it. And that World Series title probably deserves to, if not be stripped, then rightly looked at with scorn. But they still have a ton of talent, cheating or otherwise. You can't tell me that Springer and Correa and Altuve and on down the list aren't still good major league hitters. Sure, they were benefiting, but they're still very, very good hitters. And to be getting the starting pitching that they've gotten, especially we saw it again last night from Valdez, McCullers has been really good, obviously Greinke. They have more talent top to bottom. The rotations, you probably still give it by a slight margin to Tampa, but it's a case of, well, star power seems to be winning out over situational managing and playing the percentages and platoons and kind of a Charlie Hull staff, not just your pitching staff, but your entire team. And I just wonder, in a Game 7, would I take the depth of the Rays and their ability to play situational baseball and make substitutions based on who's on the mound, defensive or otherwise? Or would I take the proven star power of Houston? And obviously the fact that Houston's won the last three games probably is motivating the decision a little bit, but it's hard not to lean with Houston considering the momentum and considering their talent advantage.
Yeah, without question, I would agree. Charlie Morton might be the X factor here. You talk about a guy who has been around these teams, these franchises, big games before. Star power. Now, Charlie's not considered a star in the same way, Clayton Kershaw, Justin Verlander, who's not pitching in this series for the Astros. And by the way, let's give the Astros some credit for advancing as far as they did without him. But when you look at that experience factor, because see, Josh, to me, there's always a difference in baseball compared to other sports. I do. Emotion, heart, all the stuff that can't be put onto a Excel spreadsheet and analyzed and diced and through analytics is a big part of the game. I totally get that. And in fact, I'm a big proponent of that. However, I'll amend it a little bit when push comes to shove. When you get into a game like this, though, the pressure factor does come into it. And where baseball is different than hockey and basketball, football, look, if emotion really swings in a hockey game between the 7-game series, if this was a hockey series and you'd won the first three and lost the last three, then the emotion, the body checking, the physicality, all of it plays into it. It's baseball, though. If Charlie Morton's dealing tonight, so much for momentum for the Astros. That is a difference in baseball. It begins and ends with the next day's starting pitcher. That's why I think the Rays may have another one in them, but you're so right about the Astros. They cheat all they wanted. And remember, you know, they were primarily using their cheating at home, and they have played this entire series, and nobody, well, at least we hope not, nobody's cheating in this series. It's still a very powerful baseball team. I think it's going to be a great game.
Yeah, it should be. And you know, there's not a lot that would separate the two teams, you would think. You know, the starting pitching matchup seems pretty even. McCullers, you know, gave up the three-run homer, I believe it was in the first inning, but it was after Altuve made the error. And then he was basically lights out the rest of the way. I think he struck out 11 in six innings, was absolutely razor sharp with all of his pitches. And as good as Morton is, McCullers is equally as capable of having that kind of shutdown inning. I would be surprised if the offenses are clicking either way. I would probably bet more on Houston being able to string together, you know, at bats. Like Michael Brantley has been terrific this entire series, and he's the type who, you know, in a game seven is unlikely to have a bad at bat and could really, you know, be the type to swing a close game. But if it's tight, bullpen-wise, I feel like I probably am going to go with Tampa Bay. I understand, you know, Houston's been using Christian Javier out of the bullpen, and he started for them in the regular season, but he pitched last night. And Presley has been up and down. They've certainly missed Osuna. What he has been able to do throughout his career and him not being available has been a huge loss to that bullpen. I think Houston's hope has to be that they get to Morton early and then can kind of sit on a multiple run lead, a three or more run lead, because if it's close in any way, then I got to give the advantage to the Rays, because I just look at their bullpen as being so vastly superior to what Houston can throw out.
Agreed. Another factor, though, that enters into this, Josh, and I don't think there's any doubt about this one, is that it's seven games in 7 days consecutively. And the advantage of the bullpen for Tampa Bay is still there, but I think we've seen as the series has gone on that they're asking guys to come in night after night after night. It's a little more difficult. And yes, in a game seven, everybody empties out the bullpens. I get that. Everybody's available. There's nobody that's not available to get you an out if you need one in a game seven when the alternative is go home. But I think another interesting and unique thing about this series is the back, 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 all of the stuff that has come with them is really incredible, because 7 games in 7 days is more of a challenge than any other time we've seen it in this world. We have never seen this before. So yes, the bullpen is important. Tampa Bay's bullpen has not been as good the last couple of games, which I think has been a factor. And the fact that we've had 7 games in 7 days without that break, Josh, that to me is, I don't want to say it's a difference maker, but you know, you talk about guys fresh and the day between pitches and the number of them. I think we saw it with Castillo. You know, he's been magic, and just, you know, you can't depend on it every single time out. So I agree with you. I think the start of the game is important. Who gets a lead is important. And I think Charlie Morton's got to pitch deep into this game if Tampa Bay's going to win.
Well, we saw last night, right, Valdez, you were going into that game saying, well, if he could give you certainly 15 outs, if he could give you 5 innings of quality starting pitching, you would certainly take that. But if he could give you 6, then you were probably going to win the ball game. And you look at what he did last night, and he was as good as you could have ever hoped, right? 6 innings, 3 hits. He strikes out 9, gives up 1 run. And I think it's sort of the same situation. I understand game seven and it's all hands on deck and in the kitchen sink to get to the World Series. But you're right about the fact that bullpens have been used here every single day. There hasn't been the benefit of the off day kind of baked in, so you can have that ability to give a bullpen arm a blow here or there. Everyone has been throwing every single day, or if not every other day. And I just wonder, you know, if either team is unable to get more than 4 innings out of their starting pitcher, what kind of, I guess, innings we could expect from a relatively taxed bullpen, and especially in such a magnifying glass, high-tension scenario of a Game 7 of the American League Championship.
Yep, should be fun indeed. That's a Game 7 of the ALCS. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you. Reach us on Twitter at TheRog590, at JGoldberg12, or text 590-590 with your name and your location. You want to weigh in on anything we're talking about. Michael Bradburn will join us. He's got baseball coverage at The Score, and we'll talk to him about the Astros and Dodgers and Braves and Rays, and let's us talk about the NLCS for a few minutes, Josh. Another intriguing and very good series, although not as dramatic due to the lopsided nature of a lot of the scores of the games. Kind of funny. It's been a very close series, runs scored-wise, but we've had blowout after blowout, and especially, I think, what we saw, Josh, in that series. And listen, full credit to the Braves. They've been the underdogs. They've been terrific. They are more than capable of still winning this series, 100%. They have great young talent. They got to be excited about where they're going. Alex Anthopoulos has done a great job. I'm putting all those caveats out there. Just, I look at that Dodger lineup and the way they can explode for runs, and we saw it at the end of Game 2. It was not quite enough to come back. Game 3, 11 runs, obviously, historical performance in the first inning. Even after losing 10-2, they bashed the ball again last night. That's the thing in this series, regardless of what the score is, at any time in this ball game with the Braves ahead, the Dodgers still have the ability to turn on. That said, the Braves bullpen has been terrific. Their young pitching has been great. They got great young stars. So another one, you don't have to analyze game 6 and game 7s of series to death, because obviously the teams are equal or they wouldn't be playing a game 6 or a game 7. I still don't think we've consistently seen the best of what the Dodgers can bring, but it hasn't that been the story of the Dodgers in the postseason the last 8 years?
Well, what I'll say here, and this might be something that a lot of people, yourself included, could disagree with, I think if Atlanta doesn't win tonight, and maybe this isn't that out there because, you know, they would be heading into Game 7 with no momentum and having lost 2 in a row, but I think they have to win tonight or they're not winning the series. And more than anything, it's because they have Max Fried going this afternoon. He's been their stud. He's been their ace. You know, he didn't lose a game all regular season. He hasn't lost a game in the postseason. His ERA in the regular season was 2.25, 2.65 so far in a couple of starts in the postseason. He wasn't great against the Marlins, but he was terrific. I think he's given up one run over his last 13 innings and his last two postseason starts. He's your guy. He's your guy that you expect to go out there and give you 6 innings and pitch you to the World Series. And it's not going to be easy because you look at the Dodgers lineup and it's relentless. There's really nobody in there that you would say is an easy out, but Bueller with his blister, and we're not sure his command wasn't really there. He walked 5 in game 1. You got to give the advantage in the starting pitching matchup to the Braves. And if for any reason they pitch to a draw or even Bueller out pitches Fried, As good as the Braves bullpen has been at points, the Dodgers have the best bullpen, I would say, probably in Major League Baseball. And it was terrific last night in a win or go home situation. May only gives them 6 outs, but then they basically shut down the rest of the game. I think they gave up one run the rest of the way. And, you know, you cannot go into a situation if you're the Braves where I think if the game is tied or you're down a run or more against that Dodgers bullpen, because you just realistically can't expect to get a ton against them.
No, you can't. And that's indeed the case. And agreed, because the pitching matchup seems to favor the Braves, although you never really know in the pitching matchups. One of the caveats of the Dodgers in their time, there has not been a better regular season pitcher than Clayton Kershaw in the major leagues. Clayton Kershaw is eventually going to the Hall of Fame, and he's got tons of baseball left. It's even unfair to say, well, future Hall of Famers, like Clayton Kershaw could win a couple more Cy Youngs. He's still in his early 30s. He still has an opportunity. He is still a great pitcher. But as is the case with, and I'll use David Price as an example, but there have been other pitchers. Josh, you just cannot, the stats don't lie. And I know, and Mike Wheeler and I talked about it last night, and I do agree, it is, relatively speaking to his regular season work, a microscopic percentage of time that he's been in championship series. And it's not that he's been horrible. It's not that, you know, he gets knocked out in the first inning or he gets nerves or whatever and just can't get anybody out. And Price was terrible in a lot of preseason games until he finally had some World Series success with the Red Sox. But when back to Kershaw, he's been good. He's been a good pitcher. His ERA in the playoffs is something like 4.37. That's good, especially at this stage. He pitches deep into games, which most pitchers don't do. But when you compare that to the way he is in the regular season, it just shows you that sometimes the guy you think is going to be the guy you can count on isn't the guy that you can count on. And once again, unless Kershaw can pitch in Game 7 in relief and kind of salvage it, if the Dodgers lose again, that discrepancy between regular season Kershaw and playoff Kershaw is going to be talked about.
Yeah, it has to be, right? It really does. And, you know, again, I feel like this has been the case for him so many times throughout his career in the playoffs, is he seems to be pitching well, and then all of a sudden in, you know, one particular inning, a lot of times the fifth or sixth or something like that, after four or five quality innings, he just, you know, maybe the command isn't quite there, the pitches aren't quite as effective, he's leaving them just enough over the part of the plate where somebody can put bat to ball, and they just start finding holes. He didn't give up home runs or anything like that. He just gave up, you know, a bunch of singles kind of stacked on top of each other. But at the end of the day, he gave up, I believe it was four runs in five plus innings into the sixth inning. And, you know, fair or not, it's going to follow him, and it always will. I think they have to win a World Series, and he has to pitch well in a World Series performance for any of these calls to lessen at all. Because even if he pitches mediocre and they win a World Series, people are still going to say, well, okay, he got the World Series, but his playoff success is rough. If he really has, like, let's say it goes seven games and maybe he pitches twice in the World Series, or even he just has one great start, seven innings of shutout, and they win the World Series, then I think, you know, people are still going to poke holes because that's just the way it goes. But I do think that some of those cries, some of those calls might be lessened a little bit. It's just a case of you got to win. Otherwise, that reputation is always going to follow you around.
Yeah, that's the fortunate or unfortunate, depends on how you want to look at it, the way we look at sports and big games and winning when it matters the most. We'll see. So we got a Game 7 and a Game 6 coming up later today. We have the Game 7 between Tampa Bay and Houston. That comes up at 8 o'clock. Josh and I are with you. We're going to continue to talk baseball. As I mentioned, Michael Bradburn is going to join us. And we're going to talk hockey, NFL, and NBA on the show today. And speaking of hockey, Ailish Forfar will join us, for a co-host of the NHL Chat Room on Sportsnet's YouTube channel. And we'll talk to her about primarily what the Toronto Maple Leafs have done. And Josh, you know, you stop again and you look at it, and there's no guarantees, and you never know, and people can say what they want, but I broke it down this way as to, so here are the Maple Leafs, uptight against the cap, they've committed to their star players, it's free agent day, they did bring in TJ Brody, but they did lose players back and forth, so I'm going to ignore that one, but I'm just going to look at it, you know, a team that's locked so much money into Tavares and to Marner and Nylander, we know that, you know, they're so, you know, and there's no way to get around that outside of trading one of those guys, which you're not going to do. Not trading Matthews, not trading these guys. So what do you do? Well, you fill out the rest of your roster as cheaply and as best as you can. So, and I know Spezza is a re-signing, but Jason Spezza, Joe Thornton, Jimmy Vesey, Zach Bogosian, Wayne Simmonds, okay? Five players. Combined salary, $4.8 million. That's good work in my mind, Josh. I don't care if it works out or not. That's five experienced veteran players added. You know, Spets is not an ad, but you know what I mean. At $4.8 million combined, Josh. So if it doesn't work, all right, it doesn't work. But end of the day, that's pretty good value for $4.8 million, even with the age of some of those guys.
Great value. I understand that the fact that the Leafs haven't won anything over the last couple of years and the way some of those contract negotiations have gone, I think has soured a lot of people. And I can't blame you. But at the end of the day, you were looking at this offseason as, well, the cap situation, the cap is going to be flat. The Leafs don't have a lot of room as it is. How are they going to get better, and how are they going to be tougher to play against? And now everyone's looking at their offseason and saying, well, now they're too old and they're too slow. They brought back Spezza. They signed Thornton. Wayne Simmons doesn't have great foot speed. He never did, but he certainly doesn't have what he used to have. And if that's your argument or your criticism now, it's just a case of, well, nothing they were going to do is going to enable you to say, well, they won this offseason. They did a good job this offseason. It wasn't going to happen. There was nothing they could do that was going to change your mind. And some people, I think, you know, it's impossible to please until there's actual legitimate results in terms of winning in the playoffs. But there's no question with the pickup, especially of Brody and, you know, Joe Thornton may be 41 years old, but I think in the right situation, he could still be an impactful player on the power play, playing with the right players around him, as we saw when he finished the season on San Jose's top line. I think he had 12 or 13 points in his last 19 games, which is pretty damn good for a 41-year-old. There's a lot to like here, but at the end, when push comes to shove, the Leafs are only going to go as far as their stars are going to take them. That may be obvious to say. All of this is just background noise. Until Matthews, Tavares, Nylander, Marner, Riley, Anderson, I would say that's the six that you're looking at, all put it together simultaneously, consistently in the playoffs, then the Leafs aren't going to go anywhere, no matter how great Wayne Simmons, TJ Brody, Jason Spezza, Joe Thornton, Jimmy Vesey, whoever else plays. It's going to be your stars or you're not going anywhere.
That's exactly right. But that was also true before you made those moves. And you have to address that. We could have made that exact same statement if the Maple Leafs had done nothing. They'll only go as far as their players go. And I go back to what I said at the start. It's these guys are locked up long term. So what do you do in the meantime? $4.8 million for Thornton, Spezza, Vesey, Bogosian, and Simmons. Are they slow-footed, older? Yeah, they're also now third- or fourth-line guys. You're counting on Matthews and the big stars on this team to get it done. I don't know how anybody cannot like that work. But if you don't, or you do, text us, 590-590 with your name and location, 590-590, and we'll read your text. Reach us on Twitter at TheRaj590 or at JGoldberg12, and you can email Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. Josh and I are with you until 8 o'clock Eastern. Baseball coverage at The Score is provided by Michael Bradburn. He's also the co-host of Expand the Zone podcast. We're going to talk to him about Game 7, the two best words in sports, next. Sportsnet Today continues. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Sportsnet 590 FM.
Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you until 8 o'clock Eastern. In a few moments, Michael Bradburn joins us from The Score. Ailish Forfar from Sportsnet's YouTube channel. And we've got Kevin Kurz from The Athletic talk about the Sharks as well. You got to wonder, and we'll get more from Kevin, Josh, how the Sharks feel about Joe Thornton. Because, you know, especially here in Toronto, once you become a Leaf, your magnifying glass grows and grows, and now every move is done. You don't have to be Joe Thornton. You can be a fourth-line guy. All of a sudden, everybody, if Jimmy Vesey thought he was going under the magnifying glass or wasn't earlier in his career, just wait till he gets to Toronto. But that said, you wonder how the Sharks feel about all this because, I mean, you know, end of the day, they didn't win. They went to one Stanley Cup final in 20 years.
Yeah, well, and Patrick Marleau's going back, right? And Thornton's leaving, and it's just, yeah, this it just goes to show, right, how bloody hard it is to win a Stanley Cup really any day, but especially in the cap era. San Jose has been so consistently solid for so many years. I think they made it to the Western Conference Final four times, and one cup final is all that they could muster up with double-digit playoff appearances with Joe Thornton in the fold. It's tough, right? And he's just looking for one more opportunity to get there. And no question the Leafs next year have a better chance to win the cup. But I just wonder, you know, he should probably be able, in addition to his just experience of being 41 years old and in his 23rd season in the league, he can probably give some advice to the Matthews, Marner, Nylander, even John Tavares, to say what it's like to have this success in the postseason and maybe get somewhat over the hump and how difficult it is to close out a series, close out a team. His experience and just his presence in that locker room, I think, is going to be crucial.
We'll talk to Kevin Kurz about the San Jose perspective on Jumbo Joe in our 4 o'clock hour. But right now, let's talk some baseball. Michael Bradburn is with us from The Score, also the co-host of Expand the Zone podcast, to talk about tonight's Game 7. Michael, thanks for joining us. Hope you and yours are safe and well. No two better words in sports than Game 7. If you buy into momentum, well, it should be all Houston Astros tonight. If you don't and you still look at a game where everybody's available, especially pitching staffs and fundamental baseball, maybe you side with Tampa Bay. But, Michael, what do you think of the first six games of this series? Because they have certainly been very different.
It's been wild, yeah. It's certainly a roller coaster the entire series. I thought the Rays would honestly wrap it up in four once they had that momentum. But, yeah, the Astros, I was foolish for counting them out. They're an incredibly good baseball team, particularly when the lineup is hitting. And, honestly, the Rays' bats have gone exceptionally quiet against a relatively mediocre staff, other than Framber Valdez, who looked unbelievable.
Yeah, I want to ask you about Valdez in particular, who's, you know, 26 isn't old by any means, but in terms of, you know, prospects or anyone coming up to the big leagues, it's definitely, and making this kind of impact, it's definitely on the older side of things. Are you surprised, like almost shocked, that he's been able to have this kind of success, you know, as a major leaguer, making, you know, only 23 career starts?
Incredibly surprised, yeah. This was not somebody I thought would break camp and be, you know, irreplaceable for the Astros. He's been nothing short of exceptional the entire season. It's just like the Astros wouldn't be where they are without Valdez too, and that can't be overstated. Like the offense sucked all year, nothing short of sucking. And like Altuve did not hit. Bregman was kind of meh. The only good hitters all year were pretty much George Springer and Michael Brantley. And, you know, the bats have come awake in the postseason when it matters most. That's good. But they wouldn't be here if it weren't for Valdez. And, yeah, like you said, a guy who's 26 doesn't really possess that elite strikeout stuff. Yeah, you wouldn't expect that guy to step up when the Astros really needed him.
You know, what's interesting about the whole thing, guys, is that, and there's no way to quantify this, or because it's just a what if question, but this 2020 season obviously has been unique, and that's putting it mildly. But we talk about not just in this series, but especially the Braves with their young pitchers. And then we saw a game with five rookies pitching in the same game. Like, you kidding me? This is craziness, the kind of stuff we're seeing in the postseason. But then you stop and you think, but remember, you know, there's no crowds. A lot of the pressure, the tension comes from the crowds, the atmosphere. And yes, you're still playing in the World Series, and I get it. And I should say that in the National League Championship Series and in the World Series, the attendance is 10,700. But, you know, it looks like just when they scan the crowds, it's kind of funny. They're letting some people in, but clearly they're keeping the social distancing. But my point is the standard traditional experience, the tension that would really get to some players, whether they're young or old, does it even really apply this year? And if I can add, Michael, your thoughts on that, and to the fact Josh and I were mentioning earlier, 7 games in 7 days now, does that change the landscape in terms of who's ready? I know everybody's ready in a game seven. We got a lot of tired bullpens here because there's been no days off.
For sure. This has been an incredibly odd season. And I think one of the reasons you saw so many rookie pitchers in the postseason too is not only because we've had some opt-outs at the onset of the year, but also because injuries were so prevalent this year. The Rays dealt with a ton of injuries in their bullpen. The Astros, of course, lost Justin Verlander, which was looked like it would take them out of things, but it didn't. So we're seeing a lot more rookies. You know, Shane McClanahan for the Rays actually made his Major League debut. He's the first pitcher ever to make his Major League debut in the postseason. So that's an unbelievable thing. And yeah, just the fact that, like you said, 7 games in 7 days, you're seeing teams rely on guys who you wouldn't typically see, but have earned their shot here too. Like, Shane McClanahan is an elite prospect, unbelievably good. He looks a little shaky, to be perfectly honest. He's on the biggest stage, you know, as you'd expect from a young prospect left-hander. But, you know, it's just, it's a wild, wild season, and you're seeing, as a result, some weird things. Even Ryan Weathers for the Padres on the other side of things made his major league debut this season. He's the second pitcher ever to make his major league debut in the postseason. So, yeah, very, very weird year.
Looking at the pitching matchup tonight, McCullers, Morton, both very capable of missing a lot of bats and dominating. And we saw McCullers basically do it after the first inning homer earlier in the series. And Morton's been terrific. But I guess who are you more confident looking at the other lineup that one of these starting pitchers could go 6 innings and, you know, strike out 8 or 9 and give up 1 run or less?
Oh, geez. I expect neither of them to go especially deep into the game, to be perfectly honest. I think both managers will be pretty quick with the hook. We've seen a little bit more leniency with Dusty Baker because he's a bit of an old-school guy. He stuck with Greinke in the sixth when nobody expected him to stick with him. He ended up striking out Randy Arozarena, who's the hottest person on the planet, and Mike Brasseau, who hit that home run up for Oldis Chapman. All that is to say, McCullers has looked shaky. But I don't know. Like, I'm kind of done betting against the Astros at this point. It's foolish. Like, this Astros team is too good, and the Rays lineup is not hitting. They look bad, to be perfectly honest. Other than Arozarena, everybody in the lineup just exceptionally cold, especially the last 3 games. But even in the first 3 games, they relied pretty heavily on their run prevention to get things done. That doesn't seem to be working anymore. But I don't know. I'm going to bounce back and forth on this. I'm probably still sticking with Charlie Morton against his old team.
Yeah, Morton pitching against his old team. Another sideline, interesting component of this Game 7 as well. Comes up tonight on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Pregame coverage starts at 8 o'clock. Game 6, the Dodgers stay alive. And if you're a Dodger fan, you're going, Will Smith. And if you're an Atlanta fan, you're going, oh, Will Smith. And I guess it's 2020 because that's the first time, and I thought it was the first time in Major League history during the postseason that two guys with the identical names were facing each other in a game. How 2020 is that? And how 2020 is it that in all the years and all the times the Dodgers have not been able to do it in the postseason, they can find a way to win Game 6, Michael? Perhaps this is the year they finally crash through, or else the Dodgers' legacy of being, yeah, best team in the regular season again, guess what, you don't even get to the World Series. How many kicks at the can do the Dodgers get? Although when you look at their lineup, maybe this is just going to be, they're going to keep coming until they finally get it right.
Yeah, it feels like every single year we keep saying, like, this is the most frustrating year for the Dodgers. But I really do think if they lose to this Braves team, it will be the most frustrating because, you know, they made – Max Fried was unbelievable all year. Almost did not allow a home run the entire season. Went a perfect 7-0. He was great, unequivocally. However, he does give up strings of hits, so long as you're not trying to barrel him up. He had the lowest barrel rate of any pitcher, I believe, this year, of any starting pitcher at least. He was incredibly good. However, the Dodgers need to switch their game plan against guys like that. Elite teams like this need to elevate their performances when it matters most. And trying to go deep off Max Fried, especially in Globe Life Field that suppresses home runs, is not how you beat Max Fried. And, like, to me, it would be unbelievably frustrating if the Dodgers lose to this particular iteration of the Braves, having dropped, you know, at least one of the Max Fried starts, if not both.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. And I think if they win tonight, I like their obviously like their chances to win this series. And you know, honestly, if you were looking at the Dodgers and saying who was going to be the standout offensive player so far for them in the postseason, you would probably look at Betts and you would look at Bellinger and you might even look at somebody like a Turner or Muncy before you would get to Corey Seager. And it's because you know he was hurt a couple of years ago, and then last year he was solid but not as good as he was a couple of years ago, had a good regular season, but you know, you look at the numbers, he's driven in 14, he's hitting over 340. Is it just a case of he's back to the player who, you know, was talked about as a future MVP candidate and a future, you know, maybe best shortstop in all of baseball type of player?
Yeah, he's absolutely an MVP caliber player. We saw actually pretty early in the year, about 2 weeks into the season, he quickly became a Statcast darling, where he was like leading the league in ex-WOBA with like unbelievable hard hit rates. So he was hitting the ball exceptionally hard. Results weren't quite there, but this is just an actualization of his talent. Like you said, we haven't seen enough of him because he's been out of the lineup quite a bit in his career. But honestly, I really do think if healthy and on his game, he's the best shortstop in baseball. And that's saying something, too. We're kind of in a golden age of shortstops. There are some incredibly good shortstops right now.
Now, Michael, before we let you go, I guess a general summation of what we've seen so far, and I'm a little hesitant to even proclaim the season done and a success. However, you know, they're going to the bubble or however you want to call that in Arlington for the World Series. And despite some real bumps in the road and a terrible start and the Cardinals and the Marlins situation that dragged out, baseball joins the NBA and the NHL. And again, I'm knocking on wood as I say this, as getting it done during COVID and going through it. And I've made this comment many times about the NHL and the NBA, and I'll make it about MLB, and I'll just use certain games in particular. Yankees-Tampa Bay, Game 5. That was one of the best baseball games I've ever seen. I don't care if there was nobody in the stands. I don't care if it's done during COVID. I don't care if this year is weird and they only played 60 games. Just the quality, the fact that they could pull it off is one thing. But they've pulled it off, and we're talking about some great baseball here, are we not? Should we not at least a tip of the cap at any conversation that the fact that they even managed to get this done should count for something?
Yeah, for sure. I think so. I think they should have still been more careful with, you know, dividing up teams into specific bubbles. They probably shouldn't have fans in the stands in the NLCS and World Series. I'm generally opposed to that. However, like you said, we're seeing some incredible baseball. I believe in the ALCS as well, at least the tying run has come up in the on-deck circle in every single game of the Astros-Rays series, which is unbelievable. Like, that's, if you want tightly contested baseball, even if the series did go up 3-0, that series has been unbelievably entertaining. We're seeing home runs off of, like, Nick Anderson, who didn't give up home runs all year. It's honestly, it's been one of my favorite postseasons to watch. But I feel like I say that pretty much every year.
Yeah.
I love baseball. I don't know. I'm paid to watch baseball. It's incredible.
Yeah. Hey, Michael, I hear her. Cheers to that, because I feel the same way. Believe me, I think it's great stuff every year. I guess I appreciate it more this year because of the weird circumstances we're doing in. And I don't even see the difference between this year and previous years. And that probably says it all. Michael Bradburn, baseball coverage at The Score, joining us here on Sportsnet today. Michael, thank you. Pleasure to have you on.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael Bradburn, joining us. Josh, it has been great stuff. There is no doubt. And I like the way Michael says it, you know. Well, yeah, really, it's my favorite postseason, but I say that every year. That's exactly my point. It isn't any different than any other year. But let me ask you, what do you think? 10,700 people are at the NLCS. Is that a good idea?
I could see both sides of the coin on this one. Probably not. But if you're spacing them out, maybe, I don't know. It's just the virus is surging again globally, it seems like, and certainly in the United States, and we can obviously say the same thing here at home in Ontario and in Canada. Probably not. I feel like if you're going to have sports going on, just limit the amount of exposures you're bringing into the equation. And I understand part of that is, well – fans drive revenues, and fans being in the stands helps, you know, just the sustainability of your leagues going forward. So I get that that is part of the equation. It's just, it's a tough one to come to grips with when, you know, this thing is still obviously ongoing and you're just bringing more possible exposures into play.
Yeah, I agree. I do see the need. Look, until there's a vaccine, we got to find a way to do business.
For sure.
We got to, or Josh, we're all going to be broke. That's just the fact of the life. It's a matter.
Sure.
However, I do agree, because every time you say that, you know, you can't say anything in the middle anymore, because they're, oh, you're saying open everything up. No, I'm not saying open everything up. But to the point of the 10,700, I just don't get the point of 10,700. You know, I could see, all right, if you're just making a statement and trying to show, okay, well, then 5,000. Like, really space them out. Make sure nobody gets it as a result. What does 10,700 do for your economic model? Like, are they charging that much for the tickets? Like, is it like, well, like, does it really, for that amount of risk? Like, there's risk and reward of everything, right? It's the same thing. Should the kids be back in school during this? Well, ultimately, it's important for their mental health, so you're taking the chance. Kids don't usually, and I don't want to start politics here, but that's the logic that's behind that decision. So I can understand it. I don't see the logic behind just a couple of thousand people in the park. If it's that serious a situation where you should not be out, especially in the United States, then don't have anybody. Or if you just want to make a point, family, friends, 3,000 people, I don't know, 10,700 and now, well, you're charging them what? Is it $200 a ticket? Like, I don't have a calculator in front of me, Josh, but that's worth the risk?
That's it. You're spot on. You're bringing this arbitrary number in that obviously was, I think, the limit of what they felt it could be safely pulled off. Yeah, it's better than zero, but there's no way it's really doing a ton. And yeah, I guess it's more than anything just, well, let's have some fans in attendance for the biggest series of the year. I guess I get that. And maybe it's a test run for what next season might look like, because I can't envision Major League Baseball having another season of 60 or 100 or whatever number of games without fans. They're probably going to want to have a small percentage of fans. They obviously want to have 100%, but realistically, maybe this is a trial. Maybe they feel like they could get, I don't know, 30% of their stadiums full, and it's not going to be great for their bottom line and their revenues, but it's going to be better than zero fans. I would think, as much as anything, that's what this experiment is about.
Yeah, agreed. And it may come to that, especially by next April, that, all right, start in April with 10,700 if you got a 50,000 park, and then hopefully by game 110, you can get back to 50%, and the end of the season, you can have full crowds again. I guess that's indeed the case, but I just think it looks even worse than the empty stands, Josh. When they do the scan, if you paid attention, this looks stupid. I get totally empty park, but then you see a guy sitting there eating nachos by himself in a section. I'm going like, really? Like, you paid for that? Like, this makes you feel good to be a... Maybe it does. I know it's probably a deeper psychological question for another day. But if you want to comment on that or whatever we're talking about, please do. 590, 590. Name and location is our text, 590, 590. On Twitter at TheRog, 590. Email Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. Josh is on Twitter at JGoldberg12 or at Fan590. Like your feedback on whatever we're talking about. Sportsnet Today continues with Roger Lajoie and Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Josh Goldberg and Roger Lajoie with you here until 8 o'clock Eastern. Delighted to be with you. And so much to talk about. We have the ALCS, the NLCS. Leafs, we'll talk hockey with Eilish Forfar from the Sportsnet YouTube channel. Kevin Kurz from The Athletic in San Jose on the Sharks. Torrey Gurley, former NFL wide receiver, NFL analyst now. We'll talk to him about the NFL as the NFL goes on. I guess, Josh, the NFL's in the same position as baseball was, eh? Everyone's nervous here in the early going, yet as you see it start to develop, despite all these cases and postponed games and cancellations and the pain in the butt, they're limping along the same way baseball did when they had to deal with the Cardinals and the Marlins.
Yeah, they're just going to, I guess, figure it out as much as they possibly can. And it seems like the addition of a week 18 is the last thing they want to do. But that seems inevitable. And maybe we even get a week 19. But it's going to be a by hook or by crook situation here, Raj. I don't think we're getting a cancellation of the season. It's just not going to happen. I can't, unless things really, really got bad. I just don't see it happening. I think there's too much on the line here. They've already kind of went down this road here where they made it pretty clear that the overwhelming priority was to finish the season any way possible. And unless anything changes the dynamic, which is certainly a possibility because we're not really sure where things are going to go on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, but yeah, I think we're just honestly kind of numb to it at this point, which is horrible to say. But every time I see a positive test, well, I think, is it a false positive? What's the ramification of this going to be on the NFL? And I shouldn't be thinking that, but that's how I've been programmed to think about it because that's the way that the NFL's been dealing with it. If it's a false positive, then it's business as usual. If not, then they'll figure out other ways. They'll push the game back. They'll create a bye week. They'll move a game till later in the season. They'll find a way. And I guess I just am going to continue kind of rolling with the punches.
Yeah, 7 months into this, Josh, since the first shutdown of the NBA, plus a couple of days now, and we're still learning and we're still trying to figure it out. And what is a positive, a negative, false positive? What does it mean and everything? So, but end of the day, I carry a mask around with me and I don't even think about it anymore. So we do find a way to get used to things. That's for sure. Text 590-590. Tony in the Hammer says hi to my friend Rosh and Josh. And Tony, hi back to you. What a compelling series between the Rays and the Astros. Flip a coin on this one as game sevens are too hard to predict, which makes thrilling high drama. Thank you, Tony, and well said. We talked about that earlier, and it is great drama, and you can listen to it right here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sean in Mississauga says, I'm a Senators fan, and I think the Sens are being highly underestimated for how competitive they will be next year, never mind the following year. That being said, Spezza and Thornton added to your bottom lines. That's a dangerous team. Sean, thank you. I would agree with both of those. Josh, I still don't think the Ottawa Senators will be that good this year. They did add Murray, a good Branson. They've got the younger picks, but that's a work in progress. That's still going to take some time. But yeah, if you're a Senators fan, at least now you've got a reason for some optimism. And the addition of those two guys, they're not added as frontline free agents. They're third or fourth liners. Joe Thornton at 700 grand. Any team in the NHL would have signed him, Josh. Any team.
Yep. Yeah, no question. And, you know, looking at Ottawa, they need to still continue signing players, right? They still have $20 million, I believe, in cap room. I think they have 10 forwards signed and 6 defensemen and 3 goalies. They have to continue to just fill out their roster. There's still holes there. Dadonov was a nice pickup, but what do you think? Ottawa's at least 2 years away, most likely, before they're really in the conversation. More than anything, you know, the Leafs are still right there. I think they've had a great offseason, like you said, and I agree Joe Thornton would have been picked up by a bunch of teams. That Atlantic Division and that Eastern Conference as a whole is going to be tough. Buffalo is better. I don't think that they're great by any means, but bringing in a former Hart Trophy winner to play with Jack Eichel and Taylor Hall, it's hard to argue that your team didn't get better and they made other moves. Montreal, better. Josh Anderson, say what you want, impactful player. Jake Allen to take some of the burden off of Carey Price. Edmondson, still all players who can be impactful. So for a surprise playoff team, I understand they wouldn't have gotten in a normal situation. They're capable of putting pressure on Boston and Tampa and the Leafs. Florida, same thing. I think as good, if not better, than they were last year. And it's going to be tough. So the Leafs had no margin for error because they barely made the playoffs last year as it stood when the season was paused they were in. But they needed to continue to find ways to improve and tip of the cap to Kyle Dubas. But now they got to go out and execute because I don't think they're going to be the same kind of gimme games or easy games within the division with a lot of those teams improving who are below you in the standings.
Well, and that leads quickly, and we'll be quick here. Pete in Toronto says the Leafs switching to the Canadian division is a big help for them. The winner would be in the semi. semifinals compared to the division the Leafs are in now. You just outlined where the Leafs are in the division, where they are now. If that does happen, of course, that was floated and talked about by the Vegas owner, so there's some degree of credibility about it. What do you think?
That's an interesting one. I really wonder what those divisions are going to look like, right? How they're going to try and get, if that's the case, get it back for a playoffs, and how the playoff format is going to change. Sign me up, though, honestly, Raj, on a all-Canadian division, at least for a chunk of the season. I understand we're in extraordinary times, but that would be really cool to see, and I think would build up rivalries that we don't normally get to see, and fan bases, geographical, the Canadian thing. I think there's no downside to it. I really actually really hope it ends up happening.
Me too. Let's hope. We shall see. A lot of unanswered questions to come. Thanks for your text. 590-590. We'll try to get them all in. 590-590. Name and location on Twitter at TheRaj590, at JGoldberg12, and we'll read them all throughout the course of the show. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg, continue with Sportsnet today on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
First to the party and last to leave. What do you say we party together? This is Sportsnet Today. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network, Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you. And here until 8 o'clock, that's when the pregame officially starts for Game 7 of the American League Championship Series, Tampa Bay and Houston. And Josh, 2004, the Red Sox came back, the only team to do it. I never forget that series because I was on the air with my great friend, Storman Norman Rumack. Great, great guy and doing very well, by the way. We weren't on the same time. That day we were doing separate shows. And he came on before me and basically declared the series was over. As many most people do when it's 3-0. Because you know what the score, Josh, was of Game 3? 19-8.
Yeah.
The Yankees beat Boston at Fenway Park. 19-8 in the first. They won the first two in New York Yankee Stadium. Game 3 was 19-8. Well, there's no way the Red Sox are coming back. And they needed 12 innings and then 14 innings to win the next two games at Fenway, and then still had to go to Yankee Stadium and win two straight games at Yankee Stadium. And they did. And we'll see if the Astros equal that, because that is some kind of a comeback. But that's a bit later. Right now, we're going to talk about what the Maple Leafs have done. Ailish Forfar joins us. She's the co-host, along with Steve Dangle, the NHL chat room, Wednesdays on Sportsnet's YouTube channel, talking Leafs and NHL free agency time. Ailish, great to chat with you. Hope you and yours are safe and well. And let's start with the big news from the other day. Joe Thornton, 1 year at $700,000. Ailish, I think any team in the NHL would take Jumbo Joe for that kind of money, wouldn't they?
Certainly. I think there was maybe a full consensus on Twitter for the first time ever that the Leafs made a good move and nobody had any negativity, I think, about this one. So how can you not like a future first ballot Hall of Famer coming to your team and someone with so much experience? And I know he's on the older end of the age of the NHL players, but if you're looking at what he can bring just alone as a player and his experience and his character and his culture, I think you can definitely agree that the Leafs made a really good move there. And it was kind of a surprise. I think, you know, there was rumors happening and then all of a sudden it happened. And I think everyone was really excited. I certainly was.
Yeah, so was I. It's hard not to be that a player like that is going to be wearing a Maple Leaf sweater. And it's just, you know, Tavares, Spezza, and Thornton in three straight off seasons all on the Leafs at the same time. It's just, like, honestly, such a weird thing to kind of digest. And as I think about it, you know, I really wonder Thornton, especially power play-wise. And I understand the Leafs have had a good power play on and off for the last couple of years. A couple of years ago, it started hot and then cooled off. Last year, it was a bit of a disappointment. I think he could be a huge boost, particularly if they decide to put him on the first power play unit, because you can't think of, even at the age of 41, many better pure passers right now in the NHL than Joe Thornton.
Exactly. And, you know, that's an opportunity for him to show how his vision has, you know, when you've played in the league for this long, you can see the plays developing at a higher rate than even the most talented players in the league. So having him with that passing, as you said, he's one of the best passers. He's going to be able to see the play develop. It's just reps. And if you've played hockey for that long, it almost comes natural. So I can definitely see him making a huge impact on the power play that was up and down last season. So, you know, penciling him in there, seeing how it works with the younger, more talented, maybe offensive power that the Leafs have on the power play, I can see him being that missing piece, and hopefully that's something they try out whenever the season does come back. But I can see that being a huge impact for him, and then also what he brings in the dressing room and on the bench. And the Leafs have a lot of young players, so who better to mentor them and to give them, you know, a little bit of that experience and than someone like a Joe Thornton.
Thornton, by the way, had an assist, played 15 minutes and 46 seconds today in the Swiss League as HC Davos won their game 9-2. So doing what he does and getting some playing time when everybody else is at home resting up for who knows when the season does. So maybe even another bit of an advantage there. And I guess, you know, Ailish, one of the things about it, regardless of whether he contributes to the degree we just talked about or not, what's the risk? And my point, Josh and I were talking about this earlier. So Joe Thornton at $700,000, Jason Spezza at $700,000, Jimmy Vesey's another one at $900,000. Like, people were losing their minds about Jimmy Vesey 4 years ago when he was a free agent. Oh, where's he going to sign? And, oh, what a steal that's going to be. And what a player he's going to be and everything else. And I'm going, yeah, well, whatever. And as it turned out, the whatever is the case. Jimmy Vesey scored 59 goals in 4 years in the National Hockey League, and he's 27 years old. But at 900 grand, like, there's almost no loss to it. So even if Thornton or Spezza or Vesey, and we'll get to Bogosian and Simmons in a second because they're different players, you know, and different especially in age. But with those guys in particular, there's nothing ventured, nothing gained. If it doesn't work, so what? And when you're the Leafs and you've invested so much money in top players, why not spend money on guys that have at least played in this league?
Certainly, and I think one of the most surprising things about this free agency was kind of those bargain bin players that the Leafs did get, the three you named, and obviously if you look at Bogosian and Simmons as well. But those are low risk because if it's a league minimum or, you know, $1.5 million, it's something that can really click and it can make a huge difference whether they play 20 games or they're a fourth liner. And I think it's more than just looking at the stats, but it's what do they bring. I mean, I've played hockey my whole life. It's sometimes about the character that someone brings or the experience or even just a fresh start, like Jimmy Vesey. Like, if he, you know, needed a new change, maybe the blue and white is something that's going to reinvigorate him. So I think you're right. And the way the Leafs have been under that salary cap, and it was something people were a little bit worried that the free agency, the, you know, tighter cap and with the pandemic putting a strain on the flexibility and everything of the cap, I think what they did in the little bit amount of money they spent was pretty incredible.
One thing that that I guess I'm really interested, kind of a domino effect of all these signings, is, well, we saw Nick Robertson in the playoffs against Columbus, and he had his moments, and then there were other moments where he looked like an 18-year-old and was getting kind of physically overmatched. But going into the offseason, everyone kind of had him penciled in for probably a third-line role heading into next season. But with all the moves that have been made, they bring over Barabanov from Russia and Simmons and VC and Thornton. I got to wonder if maybe Nick Robertson's spot, at least to start the season, is less secure, and maybe he's somebody that, you know, you work in periodically but isn't necessarily a mainstay in the lineup right away.
I think the Leafs bottom six is actually quite deep at this point. I know I saw a tweet earlier and they were listing kind of just like a list of names that could have been what the Leafs bottom six would be. And it was a pretty deep list. And I think you're right with Nick Robertson maybe needing to prove himself once again before the end of the season. He did look like he was penciled in there. He scored, you know, a goal in the playoffs, or he made an impact in the playoffs. But now you're adding some depth there with Thornton and Simmons, and even Spezza would be down there in the bottom six at times. So you're going to have to fight it out, I think, which makes it very competitive whenever training camp comes, that, you know, he can't just wait on the fact that he did shine a little bit in the playoffs. He's got to be consistent and earn that spot. So whenever training camp does come around, it will be interesting to see how all these bottom six pieces do fit together. And I expect the Leafs to have a lot of puzzle pieces when the season does come back, and maybe not just have a set four-man or four-line unit, and maybe they'll be moving those pieces in and out quite often.
Ailish Forfar is with us, co-host of the NHL Chat Room. You can pick it up Wednesdays on Sportsnet's YouTube channel with Steve Dangle. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you here on Sportsnet today. So Bogosian and Simmons, I add them to Thornton, Spezza, and Vesey. So $4.8 million for five players, which I think is outstanding, veteran players. But the second part, especially now with Simmons, to a certain extent, Thornton as well, as one of the criticisms and concerns about the Leafs, without question, Ailish, last year, was they're not tough enough to play against. Especially if a guy like Simmons has anything left in the tank coming back from injuries, that's the kind of guy that is a prototypical tough-to-play-against kind of guy. So not only do you save money and bring in players like that, isn't that what this team has been kind of crying for?
I think fans especially have been crying for that. And I think if you look at a Simmons, a Bogosian, you know, they're pretty intimidating to play against, I would say, at this point, compared to a couple months ago when the season had ended. And if Leaf fans and Leaf Nation were looking for some grit, some sandpaper, you know, to toughen up their lineup, they definitely got what they were asking for. And obviously, Wayne Simmons taking a bit of a hometown discount there, $1.5 million, I think, for 1 year. Obviously, he's looking to prove himself as well, coming back from kind of a down year with injury. And being a local guy from Scarborough area, I think he's going to have a lot to prove as well. And he's going to know his role. He's going to need to be that big body presence, ruffle some feathers up, and that's what's expected of him. But he's also more than that. Like, he's not just a tough guy that's going to go out there and fight once in a while. He's got some skill. I think he does have some left in the tank. And the fact that he's going to be looking to prove himself this year, you know, I think that's what the Leafs will be looking for from him. And it's exciting to see like someone like a Zach Bogosian for a cheap deal as well. I mean, I know he just won the Stanley Cup, and that's experience that Leafs are looking for, someone that knows how to win and someone knows how to get there. And I know it wasn't all on his shoulders, but just that experience of having someone that knows how to get that grit and that toughness to get what is expected, that final goal of winning the cup. So you can't be mad with any of these. I would say, at least, I mean, I'm obviously a little bit biased, but I've been looking for, oh, what's the catch? But I think the way you spend, you just said five players for almost $5 million or something, like it's a pretty good offseason so far.
So, rightly so, the blue line has been looked at as a weak spot for the Leafs for the last couple of years, really as long as I can remember. And with the pickup of Brody and just looking at the blue line top to bottom, is this the best Leafs blue line we've seen in maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20 years?
I'd like to say so. I just think, like, even looking at who Morgan Rielly had to play with over the last couple of years. I know Steve and I talked about this on NHL Chat Room, and he listed off a couple names of who Morgan Rielly alone had to play with. And it was rough, right? And he's supposed to be one of the top defense on the team, and at times number one. So if you're looking at who he had to play with over the last couple of seasons, and now having like, okay, TJ Brody can be that number two, and they can be together and have, you know, some security as a D pairing, or even just knowing that there's a little bit more depth. And I mean, I feel like the Leafs blue line was injured half the season last year, which was difficult, but having, you know, some pieces that you're not worried about them being on the ice necessarily, and you can breathe as a fan and watch, like, you know, some chemistry happen, and hopefully no injuries are to come. But it definitely is one of the strongest blue lines, I would say, and probably a nice feeling for someone like a Morgan Rielly to have a little bit of help. You know, he was kind of the one people would put the blame on because he was holding up the blue line basically by himself at times. So I think these pieces coming together will just kind of take a little bit off his shoulders as well.
Yeah, I'm kind of smiling hearing you guys talk about that because Dave Cameron, who I know for a lot of years in junior hockey, I remember he told me one time, he said, if you don't have a legitimate number two defenseman, you don't really even have a legitimate number one, because the number one can't be a number one if he doesn't have a guy to fall back. Who's he playing with? And I told, you know, it makes so much sense, especially when you look at Morgan Riley and his career, and you guys both nailed it on that. So good on you. So we've already talked, and Ailish, you mentioned several times when they finally start playing. So who knows when that is, but our degree on how the Leafs season unfolds, and let's just call it the 2021 season. That's one thing. There will be no hyphen this year in the NHL. This is just going to be the 2021 season. But whenever it does take place, if the Vegas owner is right and they decide to put all the Canadian teams together in one division, some people think that automatically makes the Leafs in better shape than they would be if the season just unfolds with the regular divisions and the way they are now. I don't know about that when I look at the vast improvement of some of the Canadian teams, but maybe just talk about that. And what would you think of an all-Canadian division?
I think it would be super interesting and fun as a Canadian to just have a full-on Canadian league in a sense. But I don't think it just automatically gives the Leafs their ticket to the finals. I would say that if we start from the West, you know, Vancouver had a awful weekend by losing Jacob Markstrom, losing Chris Tanev to their rival Calgary Flames. So I think that was a pretty bad start. And then they lose Troy Stetcher, you know, and then it was a tough weekend for them. And the fact that two of their top players that I just mentioned went to a division or a Calgary rival just obviously isn't a great look. I mean, they did sign Nate Schmidt and Holtby, but I don't think that they're coming out on the positive end of that weekend. I know I saw Fire Benning was trending. So, I mean, Vancouver fans weren't too happy this weekend. So a team that kind of feels like they're up and down, going through rebuilds and then not going through rebuilds, and I would say that the Leafs would have an upper hand on them. But I was impressed with what the Montreal Canadiens did, especially being able to lock in Brendan Gallagher and adding, you know, some big key components that they were looking for. I'm not going to say that I think that they're going to be a huge playoff push this year, but they did what they needed to do by adding like a Toffoli and a Josh Anderson and even getting a Jake Allen for some backup and then Joel Edmondson. So I think that they've improved vastly as well, almost as much as the Leafs. And maybe it could be an argued that they people were saying that maybe they were the winners of free agency, but they're still spending a lot of money on goalies. And people love to say that they're paying the most for the goalie tandem in the whole league. So the Canadians were an interesting team. I'm excited to see how they fare this year. And then even the Ottawa Senators, who had a really good draft, and I mean, they're coming from the basement, so they've got some ways to go. But if you look at some of the improvements that just those three teams alone made, it'll be an interesting Canadian season. I hope that if the playoffs do continue, we see more Canadian teams, you know, being able to make an actual push and not just having to rely on one team being Canada's team. But it's interesting. There's a lot up in the air, and I think most of the Canadian teams did make some improvements, which as a Canadian, it's always fun to see that, right?
100%. Ailish Forfar joining us. Tune in to the NHL chat room Wednesday, 6 p.m. on Sportsnet's YouTube channel with Ailish and Steve Dangle. Ailish, great to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
You too, guys. Have a nice weekend.
You too. Ailish Forfar joining us. And that, again, that's Wednesday, 6 o'clock on the Sportsnet YouTube channel. Her and Steve Dangle have some fun in the NHL chat room. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you. In a few minutes, we're going to check in with Kevin Kurz from The Athletic. San Jose covers the Sharks and how they feel not just about Thornton bringing back Marlowe. You talk about the end of an era, and we talked about it earlier, Josh, but we mentioned the Maple Leafs and their challenges and trying to find a way to stay competitive. The Leafs in the last 3 years, I think, maybe even four, but certainly three, they kind of remind you of the Sharks in their early days of building their team. The difference being the Sharks did it not just 3 years, 4 years. They did it 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, as we mentioned earlier. Always there, always competitive, always good, always tough, and not breaking through. And it leads to that age-old question, Josh. And, you know, when you have, I always, you know, told my students when teaching at Ryerson and the College of Sports Media, is if you don't know what to talk about, pull out one of those arguments you can always, always get some good discussion about. And one of them is, what is a Stanley Cup worth? What is a World Series worth? So the New York Rangers have won one Stanley Cup in 80 years.
Yeah.
One Stanley Cup in 80 years. But the Leafs are on a 53-year drought, and they did win in 94, and Messier won the Cup. What is that worth compared to the Leafs? Should Rangers fans feel better than the Leafs? Because the Florida Marlins are the best example. They've won two World Series. And every other year, they pretty much stink. And they dump the team immediately. So you know where I'm going at is like, so the Sharks, and Thornton is gone, but the Sharks aren't going to win. That's why Thornton's coming to Toronto. If Joe Thornton thought San Jose Sharks were close to a Stanley Cup, he would have resigned for $700,000 in San Jose and finished his career there. So what is it worth? So that's great, but they never won. They didn't win. They don't have the ring. Washington does. Tampa Bay did. They found a way to break through. And I can't think of another team that has been as good as the Sharks for as long as the Sharks in almost any other sport that didn't win. So there, should their fans take some solace in that, or should they just be mad?
I think maybe not mad, just really disappointed, almost more sad than mad, because when you have so many opportunities, like we were talking about, four conference finals, Stanley Cup final where they got to game six, and just being in the postseason conversation every year with so many great players and a core of players for so many years, to not get one, it's just really disappointing. Like, you look what's happened with Tampa and what happened with Washington, and more than anything else, it just validates the entire run. It shouldn't take anything away if you have a ton of success and you don't win a cup, but it just enhances the run if you're able to win it. We'll look back, even if Tampa and Washington win just the one cup, but they're in the playoffs every year, they've made it a couple of rounds. In the case of Tampa, they've made it to a handful of conference finals and a couple of Stanley Cup finals. You just look at that run and say, well, they won a cup, they were a competitor every year, President's trophies, a ton of great players. They were a great team of that, 5-7 year period. Whereas San Jose, you'll think back and say, well, I remember them being good, but they didn't have that defining moment of winning a Stanley Cup. And I think that's really what separates these kinds of teams in the cap era, is if you can be competitive for many, many years, just getting that that one cup, winning that one ring, really solidifies your greatness.
That's true in any sport, whether it's a cap or not. And this year's poster boys are the LA Dodgers. And we'll see if they break through, because that's one of the games coming up later, shortly actually. Dodgers trying to stay alive against the Braves. And on the Sportsnet Radio Network at 8 o'clock, we have Game 7, Tampa Bay and Houston. Houston's already won the World Series. Tampa Bay been good a lot of times, a lot of years, and haven't. They're trying to get back for the first time since 2008. We'll have full coverage on that. And we'll talk more about the San Jose Sharks, the legacy that Thornton and Marlowe leave in San Jose, and where that team is going next in moments. As Sportsnet Today continues, Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network, I'm Roger Lajoie, and Josh Goldberg is with me, and we are delighted to be with you. Reach us on Twitter. Josh is at jgoldberg12. I'm at the Raj 590. You can text 590-590 and your name and your location, please. Love your feedback. We'll read your feedback throughout the course of the show. Always great to hear from you, and always nice to hear your thoughts. Kevin Kurz joins us now. He covers the San Jose Sharks for The Athletic. Kevin, thanks very much for being with us. Hope you and yours are safe and well. So the Joe Thornton era ends in San Jose, and the Marlowe Thornton era actually ends, although it ended when Marlowe went to the Leafs. But end of the day, Kevin, the legacy of work, the fabulous career, the great stats that both Thornton and Marlowe have had in San Jose, and I know Marlowe is back now, are terrific. Yet, is there always going to be that kind of what should have been, might have been, could have been, that they only made it to one Stanley Cup final?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can ignore the fact that for all the good that they did here, and as beloved as they both are, they never got over that hump. And, it's obviously unfortunate if you're a Sharks fan. But at the same time, I mean, Thornton, in 15 years here, the team made the playoffs, and 13 of them, they made some deep runs. Obviously, some real thrilling moments here. One of the game's all-time great players is going to be known primarily as a Shark in Thornton, and you know, and Marlowe too, but particularly Thornton, because I don't think there's any question he's a Hall of Famer. And you know, I think what is he sit seventh all-time right now in assists. So, you know, I think right now that the mindset with the Sharks fan base here is they're a little devastated, and I can empathize with that, but. At the same time, I think they'd love to see him win a Stanley Cup. So if Toronto is able to make a deep run, I think he'll have some fans out here in California too.
What kind of, I guess, vacuum is going to be left in that locker room on the ice, just overall, even in the community, with Joe Thornton gone after 15 years? How big of an adjustment is it going to be for the San Jose Sharks not to have Joe Thornton around and in the lineup anymore?
Yeah, I mean, you can look at it two different ways. If you're looking at it from, you know, maybe the off-ice impact on the organization, obviously he's, again, one of the most popular, probably the most popular player that's ever played here in San Jose, at least since I've been here for 9 years. And, you know, I think that's sort of guiding the Sharks' philosophy from the front office is that this is a season in which we might not have fans in arenas, certainly probably not going to have, you know, packed arenas. So you're going to be taking a financial hit anyway. And I think that's maybe why the Sharks have approached this offseason a little bit more carefully, where they're really just sort of kicking the can to next season, I think. You know, obviously they want to compete this year, but I don't think the goal is to go all out to win a Stanley Cup. And then on the ice in the dressing room, you know, the dressing room changed when Joe Pavelski left last offseason. That was a major, you know, change to the room because, you know, Pavelski was just a true captain, somebody the team followed, really the heartbeat of the team. And as beloved as Joe was, I think Joe Pavelski was the more natural captain. And when he left and some other big personalities in the room, whether it be Brent Burns, Eric Carlson, Evander Kane, you know, they just had a tough time getting all on the same page and really playing for one another. And we saw far too many instances last year in games where the other team just wanted it more. They were playing harder, and the Sharks just never really seemed to find an identity. And that was mainly, I think, because Joe Pavelski left. I think a lot of guys would say the same thing. So Thornton leaving will be a void. But at the same time, maybe you can look at it as Logan Couture will be in the second year as captain. And by no means am I putting the culture on you know, the culture problems here on Joe Thornton, but Logan Couture could maybe take over a little bit and become a bigger voice in the room and maybe become that captain that I think this team needs. But still, that said, you know, everybody loves Joe Thornton. They're going to miss him terribly in the room. Guys like Brent Burns, Evander Kane, Logan. I mean, he's meant so much to Logan Couture's career, as Logan told me yesterday. So it will be a void, and it will certainly be a different place.
So, Kevin, let's then think for a moment or two, and you saw him throughout his career in San Jose, and the resume and the past is one thing. Tick, Hall of Famer, 100%. The emotional impact, leadership, tick, 100%. But what I think Leaf fans are trying to figure out, and probably the Leafs will have to figure out, is what does he have left physically at age 41 to still be able to contribute at the National Hockey League level, given the fact he's not going to play, get a lot of ice time with the top six forwards they have in Toronto. That's one no-brainer. Like, people talk about guys finishing their career, trying to win a Stanley Cup, change of scenery, taking 700. He is coming home, so that's that personal thing from him. But from the playing standard, we saw him get some frontline time this year with the Sharks. Frankly, a lot of it was in garbage time. But end of the day, he still performed well. He's in Davos. He had an assist today. He can still play.
Yeah.
But what do we expect from what should we expect from a 41-year-old guy who may only wind up playing third or fourth line minutes in Toronto?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be interesting because, first of all, I don't think anybody can predict how a 41-year-old is going to look after what might be a 10 or 11th month layoff when you consider the Sharks have, you know, their last game was March 11th, I think. So, you know, right away, again, you have to worry, I think, about that long layoff and how he's going to be affected by that. But, you know, I've been telling anybody that'll listen, and this was even deep in the last season when the Sharks were struggling, Joe can still play and he can still contribute. And I believe he can still contribute to a contender. And, you know, if you look at last season, you know, well, let's go back 2 years. If you go back to 2018-19, when the Sharks did make a run to the Western Conference Final, you know, Joe was on the third line with Marcus Sorensen and Kevin LeBanc. And for about a two-month stretch late in the regular season, that was the Sharks' best line. And, you know, they struggled a little bit in the playoffs. Maybe the extra minutes caught up to Joe. And you know, they didn't have quite the impact in the playoffs that maybe some would have hoped. But, again, he was still a very, very good player that year. And then you look at this season, you know, the Sharks went into the season with no depth on their wings. They had lost Joe Pavelski, Gus Nyquist, Jonas Donskoy in the offseason. They had hoped to get a push from underneath some of their prospects. It didn't happen. Joe was still on the third line. And then his line mates really took a step back. Marcus Sorensen was the most disappointing player on the team last season. Kevin LeBanc can score and work in the offensive zone, but still struggled in the other two zones. So when we saw in the second half, when Logan Couture got hurt, when Thomas Hurdle got hurt, and Joe got more minutes with better line mates, guys like Timo Meier, he was better. He could still produce. So, you know, at this stage of his career, I think you do have to surround him with obviously some good players, but Toronto has certainly better options right now to surround him with better players than the Sharks would.
For sure. No doubt. And you look at what the Leafs roster looks like, and you see some of the players he could play with. Like, I could see him being impactful on the third line with speedy players around him. And we've been talking about this throughout the show. I'm really curious to see what kind of impact he could have on the power play, because we know that, you know, in terms of power play assists, he's always been one of, if not the league leaders for years and years. And he has as good of a vision as anyone you can think of for a very long time. You know, if you plop him onto the first power play unit with Matthews, Tavares, Marner, and, you know, maybe Nylander or Riley, what kind of impact can Joe Thornton have setting up those players on the power play?
Yeah, that was maybe where he did take a little bit of a step back last season was the power play. It was hot and cold for the Sharks. You know, again, he still does have that vision, and there were still moments where he would, you know, he would be vintage Joe, and he'd set somebody up for a goal, and he would look like the, you know, the guy who won the Hart Trophy in 2006. Obviously, those moments weren't as frequent as they used to be, but yeah, I mean, on the power play, he can still protect the puck so well. He's still got that big body along the wall, creating room for other guys, waiting, being patient. You know, we know he's a passer, not a shooter, at this stage in his career. Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I actually am interested to see how they work that myself. But I have to think they find a way to utilize him in that sort of a situation, just because it is a situation that he can still thrive in.
Well, we'll see. And there's no question the Leafs are very happy to have him. So you look forward from, you know, their perspective. And you mentioned Logan Couture now taking the mantle there, Kevin. And, you know, it's easy enough to say that the Sharks are in, you know, kind of their, all right, Joe Thornton's going to Toronto because trying to win a cup, and he's not going to win it in San Jose. But so do we look, there's still some great pieces there. Where do you see the big jigsaw puzzle going in San Jose? Are they in danger of maybe being, unfortunately, if it happens this way, the new Detroit, where they just can't, you know, really do a full rebuild? They just want to stay competitive, and then eventually, you know, things just fall apart. That's what happened in Detroit. They just waited too long to do the nasty business of really doing it. Or do you look at it as, well, you know what, hold on, there's still a pretty good nucleus. Wilson's a pretty good GM, and there's enough here to keep this team, even if they're not going to win the Stanley Cup next year, that there won't be a massive, ugly 3-4 years coming up. What's the future in your mind of the Sharks?
Yeah, you know, I'm not super hopeful going into this season, just because I think there are too many question marks, you know, but if certain things come together, or if a lot of things come together, I guess, sure, could they still compete? They do. They still have a lot of high-end pieces. But, you know, the questions for me start, number one, Erik Karlsson. He had groin problems his first season here, and they affected him into the playoffs. And, you know, last season started off really strange for him. That literally opening night in Vegas, he had to fly home because his wife gave birth, and obviously that was an emotional moment for him just because of everything they had been through. And so he went through a lot, you know, between the groin surgery in the off season, signing the monster contract, welcoming a new kid, a new baby to his family. We'll see how he comes back. You know, the guy's only 30 years old. I'm not going to write him off yet, certainly. I know a lot of people think his best days are behind him, and that can very well be true. So, you know, we'll find out that. You know, the Sharks, they did add a few pieces at the wing, and they brought in Matt Nieto, Ryan Donato, they got from Minnesota. So Doug Wilson's looking for a little bit more depth on the wing just because it was so, you know, that was really their biggest weakness last season, other than maybe the goaltending. And they bring in Devin Dubnyk, who's coming off a rough season himself, and pair him with Martin Jones. I don't think that's a tandem you look at and automatically say, well, that's a playoff level goaltending tandem, just because those are two guys that have something to prove. So, we'll see. Again, I think Doug Wilson's approach to the offseason is just try to add to the periphery, see if this core group can get it together. And if they can't, that's when you make the changes, if you can. But, as you mentioned, his hands are tied a little bit just because it seems every guy on a big long-term contract has some sort of trade restriction built into that contract.
Yeah, so looking at I guess, Burns and Vlasic specifically have been pillars there for so many years. You know, Vlasic's 33, Burns is 35. Both have at least a no-trade or a no-move clause altogether. Both are signed at $7-plus million through 2025. If there does come a point where, you know, the tea leaves are there and maybe a change is best for one or both, how do you think, you know, one of those players or maybe both of those players would be in terms of maybe waiving that and moving on? Or are they pretty entrenched and feel pretty confident and comfortable that they're going to be in San Jose for a long time?
Yeah, when you look at those two, Burns is definitely the guy that would have more trade value. Just, you know, in a hypothetical scenario where both guys didn't have no trade protection. Again, Burns, but Burns can still play. He can still really contribute in the offensive end. He's never going to be Nicholas Lidstrom in the defensive end, but he still can skate. He can still fire the puck. He's still big. He takes care of himself off the ice. So I do believe Burns could be a guy that can contribute. Vlasic has really struggled the last couple of years, and he's got the full no movement clause. So I heard some things last year where he was potentially, Montreal was looking at him. That was a potential return home for where he's from. That didn't come to fruition, obviously. So I don't know. I tend to think that the Vlasic contract is the one that's probably the one that the Sharks might be stuck with. But you look at Burns, he's got a limited no move clause, so they could expose him in the expansion draft unless there's some sort of a verbiage in his contract that we don't know about. But as far as I know, they can expose him in the expansion draft. And Burns and Joe Thornton are best buddies, right? And you have to wonder if Burns is going to be as happy in San Jose here without Joe around. And you mentioned he's getting older. Does he want to be part of what could be a couple lean years here? Does he want to go try to win a Stanley Cup somewhere? So I could see that as a potential at some point. If Burns is open to a move, I do believe the Sharks would be able to find someone for him. But, the flat salary cap doesn't help any team like the Sharks for sure, because they do have a lot of these big money contracts. And we've seen just as many teams trying to shed salary this offseason as at it.
We shall see. It's going to be a very different year for the Sharks. And before we let you go, Kevin, quickly, it's going to be a very different year for everybody. You got any theories of suggestions or a prognostication of how the NHL is even going to start up? Because, after a very successful hub and the cup being presented, all good, the draft, the free agent, we get all excited. And now it's a case of, my goodness, who knows when we're going to see hockey again.
Yeah, you're talking to a guy who hasn't covered a game since March, so I'd like it sooner than later. But one agent I was talking to today mentioned the hybrid bubble again, maybe 3 weeks, maybe the Pacific Division teams or some sort of a Pacific Division, whether they split them up with the Canadian Division, they do a 3 weeks in Vegas, 1 week at home sort of thing. They got to figure it out, right, one way or another.
Got to figure it out, and hopefully they can do it and make it economically viable as well for next season. But we shall see. In the meantime, at least we've got some fresh news to talk about with Joe Thornton signing with the Maple Leafs. Kevin Kurz from The Athletic joining us to chat about it. Kevin, great stuff. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yep, anytime, guys. Take care.
Kevin Kurz joining us. Josh, that's a big thing, eh? The uncertainty now returns to us. And, we talk about it here, and you and I did so many shows during the first pause, and there was uncertainty. And now we're going back into the same thing in November, December, and who knows how long. But now there is some certainty. We know nothing's going to be happening for any while. The pressure on the NHL and the NBA to try to get it right again is going to be just as high.
Yeah, and we remember in the real long months of, let's say, April to, June, even into July when it started to become clear that the leagues were going to come back. That was looking like a gargantuan task as well. How are they going to pull off finishing seasons that were three quarters or more already completed? Now we're talking about, well, how are we going to get a season close to 82 games in the case of the NBA and the NHL? NBA's got the Olympics. The NHL's got the Olympics the following year. How are you going to do that and then eventually try and get back on your normal calendar, all while keeping it economically, financially viable? I have no idea. I guess that's why I'm not involved in the process at all. But I wouldn't even have the first idea, thought of how to do it. There's no easy answers. There's no easy solutions. Yeah, maybe these hubs of divisions by region makes a lot of sense. But are you going to be able to have fans in certain arenas? And are some markets going to be more amenable to fans than others? And how does that work for certain teams and franchises and the league and economics? It's all just such a mess. And kudos to them if they can get anywhere on it. But man, it's going to be a titanic task.
There's no doubt. And we're all the same. None of us involved in the decisions. My early guess, though, Josh, is that they try to play the full season. And they start with very, like we're seeing with the World Series in the NLCS, and they start with whatever fans they can get in, and they hope and they pray that somewhere down the road they can get back to more of an expansion. I don't see another hubble, Bob. You don't make any money off that. It costs you more money. The only reason they did it is to get their TV revenue that was already spent and to complete the seasons that have already started. So we'll see. But my guess is they will try to do, and that's why, boy, the NFL and MLB, for that matter, how their seasons wrap up are going to be very closely watched by all the leagues.
Yeah, well, we're seeing it here with more fans being added into the mix. I think, you know, how many NFL teams have fans now? A decent percentage of NFL fans have, as the Dodgers just hit back-to-back home runs. Raj, they're up
2-0.
So, yeah, I'm sure we'll dive into that more over the next couple of hours. But, yeah, like, you're seeing 10,000 fans and NFL stadiums are having 20% capacity. That's all fine and dandy, but we're talking about open roof stadiums or no roof at all. It's going to be a lot different in closed arenas, right, where there's no fresh air or anything. The ventilation system is going to have to be figured out in a way. You're probably going to do these seated pods. If you could get a third, that would probably be great, but it's all going to be very dicey because some markets will probably be in a better position to do it than others. And then just how does that work in terms of the equality sense of, you know, certain teams seeing more, I guess, revenue sharing comes into the mix a little bit, but there's no way it's not going to be a financial borderline disaster, even if you play, let's say, 82 games with no more than 25% capacity.
Yeah, it's going to be rough. There's no doubt about it. And it is, as Josh just told you, 2-0 Dodgers on back-to-back homers in the bottom of the first. We'll keep you updated on that, and we'll talk some NFL as Sportsnet Today continues. Roger Lajoie and Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Today and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie and Josh Goldberg with you until 8 o'clock. National League Championship Series Baseball coming up on the way as we have Game 7, American League Championship, pardon me, Tampa Bay and Houston. And the Dodgers are just pounding the Atlanta Braves. Added another run, just one out, bottom of the first, Josh. Already 3-0 Dodgers. I mentioned that Dodger lineup where those bats are something, and they are knocking around one of Atlanta's best pitchers right now.
Yeah, big trouble here. We were talking about this, and we talked about it with Michael off the top here, that it was really, really crucial for Atlanta to get off to a good start and you know, Max Fried to pitch well and close this thing out, because I don't want to face the Dodgers lineup more than I have to, and certainly not in a Game 7. And like Michael said, you can string together hits against Max Fried, and that's exactly what we're seeing so far. A couple of home runs, Then he walked Max Muncy, then gave up back-to-back singles to Will Smith and Bellinger. This Dodgers lineup is relentless, and I stand by it. If the Braves are unable to come back, which would be very unlikely at this rate, I think that the Dodgers are just a better ball club top to bottom, and will end up moving on to the World Series.
Well, Fried is known to give up hits, but not homers. That's the alarming part, back-to-back. And after the Dodgers put up 11 runs in the first inning the other day, they've already got three up, two on base, one out, and the bullpen is up and running, and Webb is coming in, and you can bet the Braves do not want to go to the bullpen in the bottom of the first inning, but such it is. We'll keep an eye on that. We'll get you ready for tonight's ALCS game, but coming up, we're going to talk some NFL. Kevin Massari is the co-host of the Crowd Assist podcast. We'll talk to him about the Bills in Week 6 after a very disappointing week five for the Bills. And we'll run down some of the big games coming up in the rest of the NFL in moments with Torrey Gurley, former NFL wide receiver and NFL analyst at the Champions Club podcast. Josh Goldberg and Roger Lajoie are with you. This is Sportsnet Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This is Sportsnet Today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie and Josh Goldberg with you. We are here until 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Glad you're along with us. Plenty to talk about as we lead you into tonight's American League Championship Series game number 7. The Houston Astros have been incredible. They really have, after being down 0-3 to force the 7th game. Dodgers and Braves underway, top of the 2nd inning. Dodgers up 3-0 after putting a 3 spot up in the bottom of the 1st. We'll keep an eye on that one, and maybe there'll be another game 7 we'll have for you tomorrow night. But still, 8 innings left in that one. We're going to talk NFL in this hour. Kevin Massari is co-host at the Crowd Assist podcast. We'll talk to him about the Bills. And Torrey Gurley will join us, NFL analyst at Champions Club podcast, preview week 6 in the NFL. And despite the COVID cases, the NFL is, well, getting through its schedule, Josh. We talked about it earlier, but somehow, some way, Denver and New England will play today and business goes on.
Yeah, well, I saw a list here of, I guess, the teams that have placed a player on the COVID list since yesterday. Total of 9 players from 6 teams: the Eagles, Falcons, Jags, Panthers, Patriots, and Ravens. And clearly, their new protocols, I think, are aimed at trying to nip this thing in the bud as quickly as possible. And so far, it seems as though that's going to be the case. But you know, this whole season's just based on being as flexible as possible. And if a game can't go on, we saw what happened with the Chargers schedule last week. You know, their bye week changed. They had a bunch of other games pushed back. It's just been, it's been pretty crazy. And I guess you just have to be open to the possibility, if not likelihood, that your season is going to be different and the Super Bowl could be played closer to the beginning of March than the beginning of February.
Well, joining us to talk about that and preview week 6 is Torrey Gurley, NFL analyst, co-host of the Champions Club podcast. Torrey, thanks very much for joining us. Hope you and yours are safe and well. And let's start with the COVID situation, Torrey. 9 players in 6 days, you know, getting positive tests. But the NFL is finding a way to get through the schedule, fill the holes so far. Hopefully they can do that. But as a guy who played in the NFL, Torrey, how difficult is it emotionally for these teams to get their heads around the fact that you're not sure when you're playing, who you're playing, and how the game's going to go, especially a sport that, like football, that is all done, of course, on the playbook and preparation?
Yeah, my heart goes out to any and everyone that's involved in any type of sport, but especially the guys in the NFL. You know, I have a lot of fellow teammates and brothers that are, you know, in the league, and they say it's a grind. I mean, constantly it's an influx of, you know, testing or, you know, positive, negative testing, as well as, you know, practices being up in the air. And what makes matters even worse, you go out to a stadium that holds 80 to 90,000 fans, and there is no one there in attendance. So, you know, you've been working extremely hard throughout the week to, you know, put together a great game plan, and when it's game day, not having any fans out there on top of the COVID, man, it just makes it extremely difficult for anyone in this profession right now.
Do you think that this could be a real test for, you know, how much guys love the game? Obviously, they're still playing because they love the game. But, you know, like you said, the testing, the lack of fans, it can be just kind of a test and see how that love of the game holds up over this kind of grind for 16 weeks.
Yeah, definitely. Just obviously, those guys are getting paid a healthy salary. But for the most part, the NFL is the only league that don't have guaranteed contracts outside of your signing bonus. So some people might call it for the love of the game, but you know, I'm going to speak for about 70% of the NFL, and the majority of those guys are undrafted or guys that are on the back end of the roster. They need each and every Sunday to get their game checks so they can take care of their family at home. And with this stuff being so much in the air, man, it's so difficult, and there's a lot of pressure on those guys, because not only you have to make the right decisions in the building, but when you leave the building, you know, you have to be very conscious of who you hang out with, because if you mess around and you hang out with someone and you take it back to the facility and you get your team sick and you have an outbreak, now that can jeopardize your paycheck that you get paid on Sunday. Most NFL players only get paid throughout the season, and that's for 16 weeks. So that's why you see Roger Goodell. That's why you see the NFLPA. And that's why you see the owners pushing to power through the season, because if those guys cancel games or postpone, there's a language in the CBA where they're not guaranteed to get that paycheck, and that hurts.
That's a great point, Tori, and definitely worth bringing up. This is not like a lot of other sports. There are a lot of NFL players who are on the lower scale due to the number of players in the league and roster sizes and everything. So it does change the landscape. That's for sure. So let's talk about some of the games coming up this week. Denver and New England is, well, really the poster game for not knowing when you're playing, how the game's going to go, and the uncertainty. But end of the day, they will play tomorrow. Patriots are 2-2. And of course, you know, one of the big stories of the offseason with Brady going to Tampa Bay was how would New England react without him and Bill Belichick, and of course, how Tampa Bay would go with Brady. We'll get to Tampa Bay later, but let's talk about the Patriots, the fit with Cam Newton. It's hard to get your head around it because it's been a while since they played, and Newton, of course, was one of the players that tested positive. But overall, how do you feel about that matchup between Newton, Belichick, and the Patriots? And can the Patriots, and it sounds funny to say, can they hang with the Bills this year?
I love the New England Patriots, and I love Cam Newton, and the reason why is both need each other. They moved off Tom Brady this past season, and a lot of people thought that New England was going to tank for Trevor Lawrence of Clemson. You know, he's going to be the number one player in the draft. It's not probably. It's already set in stone. This guy's the number one pick. So everyone was expecting the Jets to be as bad as they usually are, and people are expecting the Patriots to take a step back just so they can get a quarterback. But with Cam Newton coming in and most likely being comeback player of the year, this guy's been playing lights out. And really it's given Josh McDaniels, offensive coordinator, a dynamic that he hasn't had in 19 years, a dual threat. And with him being able to build this system around Cam Newton and his legs, it makes it extremely difficult for opposing teams to prepare for on a week-to-week basis. And now you get Stephon Gilmore coming back, defensive player of the year. You get him back from the COVID list. I feel sorry for the Broncos. I think this game is going to be a beatdown, and they should be able to handle business and move forward to next week.
Tori Gurley is with us, former NFL wide receiver, NFL analyst, and co-host of the Champions Club podcast. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you here on Sportsnet today. So we mentioned the Patriots, and let's talk then about Tampa Bay, 3-2 with Tom Brady, and some confusion at the end of their last game, what down it was. But overall, Brady's numbers have been decent. The Buccaneers have certainly been pretty good. Is it going to take a while until we see how really good this Tampa Bay team is going to be? Or is it going to be a matter, Tori, of the Buccaneers are going to be a fight in that division all year maybe?
Yeah, it's going to be a dogfight in the NFC South, because you have the Panthers, the Saints, as well as, Atlanta Falcons. And even Atlanta, as bad as they are, they still can you can be in a dogfight with them. But I think Tampa is this COVID new normal, this pandemic has really affected Tom Brady, because he is a person that he loves getting those reps. He loves practice. He loves OTAs. He loves training camp. And with the pandemic hitting, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers had none of that. So really, this has only been their fifth week playing with each other. And that makes a huge difference, because now they're facing a Green Bay Packer team that's been together for 2 years. Matt LaFleur and Aaron Rodgers have been on the same page, and they're humming. And people kind of, when you think of Tom Brady, you think of his greatness of him being in New England. But when you have a brand new team and a brand new culture, that stuff takes time. You know, it's like baking a cake. It's not anything you put in the microwave. This is actually putting something in the oven and letting it sit. Because everyone knows if you take that cake out too fast, it'll fall. And that's something I see that's going to happen on Sunday, is that the Green Bay Packers should really go in there and be able to take it to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, because they just don't have that continuity yet. But I think towards the end of the year, they will look better. But right now, I think they're going to continue to struggle.
So looking at the quarterback matchup, obviously nobody's going to dispute that Brady is probably the GOAT, and certainly more of a GOAT than Aaron Rodgers, because he's got six Super Bowls and Rodgers has just the one. But in terms of just pure quarterback play, ability to make all the throws, you know, play outside the pocket, use their legs, is it fair to make an argument that Aaron Rodgers is the most purely talented quarterback who's ever played in the NFL?
Oh, of course. You know, I played with Aaron Rodgers for 2 years in Green Bay, and yeah, I witnessed his greatness up front. And this guy is – he and Patrick Mahomes are the most talented quarterbacks I've ever seen, ever laid eyes on. Tom Brady has been – you know, he's really taken advantage of opportunities that his team has presented him. You know, if we think of the six Super Bowls, a lot of those Super Bowls were won by defense. Yes, did Tom Brady make some huge throws, have a big drive towards the end of the games? Yes, but for the most part, when you look at him statistically, he hasn't been that guy that just goes out and wins games on his own. That's why everyone talk about, you know, who's going to win this divorce between him and Bill Belichick. But I still give this guy his roses, because something what Tom Brady has shown is he's shown excellence. You know, it's extremely difficult to win six Super Bowls and continue to grind like you're a six-round draft pick. You know, that's something that's just abnormal. A lot of people rest on their laurels. So with Tom having that mindset of always wanting to get better, it makes it extremely easy to cheer for him. But on Sunday, you're going to see why Aaron Rodgers is one of the greatest throwers of the football, because this guy, it doesn't matter. The platform, the throw, he has it all. I mean, the guy is just – he's just gifted. So that's something you'll be able to see on Sunday, where it's like, okay, Tom Brady needs to be in the right system to be successful, and Aaron Rodgers is the system to be successful.
Torrey Gurley is with us. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg here, Sportsnet today. So, Torrey, speaking of quarterbacks, Prescott and the terrible injury last week and what happened with the Cowboys, and they did find a way to win the game, but now they have a major, major issue, of course, in the offseason, which is, well, the same issue they've had is what they do with him long term. But in the short term now, even with a 2-3 record and really not playing very well at all with or without Prescott, they're home to Arizona. Do the Cowboys have enough to get going and kind of salvage what has been a pretty poor start to this season?
Well, to answer that question, yes, because they're in the NFC East, and that's one of the worst divisions in all of football. So I think maybe 5 or 6 wins will get you the NFC East. But if you're talking about the Cowboys and being a playoff team and Super Bowl, hell no. They don't have a snowball chance in hell. I mean, this is a bad football team. Defensively, I don't know what Mike Nolan is doing. Right now, they couldn't play defense on a parked car. And that's the problem, is if you can't stop anyone, you're going to put a lot of pressure on any quarterback, if it's Andy Dalton or Dak Prescott. So I think the biggest thing with them is taking the ball off the arm of Andy Dalton and putting it in the stomach of Ezekiel Elliott, maintaining time of possession, where you can slow the game down and just turn it into a grind. Because if you try to go out there and have a shootout, it's shown over the past 4 weeks that these guys just give up too many explosive plays, and it can hurt you in the long run.
I got to ask you about Chase Claypool. Scored 4 touchdowns last week, and you know he's a athletic freak, just a playmaker all over the field. You know, a lot of people coming out of Notre Dame were thinking, well, can he be a wide receiver? Is he more of a tight end? You know, what did you make of him as a prospect? Are you surprised that he's been able to make this kind of an impact or anything approaching this kind of an impact this quickly in his rookie season?
What I'm most shocked about is someone at 6'4 that runs like he's 6'2. You know, I'm a big guy and a big receiver, and you know, I was a long strider, but man, just watching him play against the Philadelphia Eagles this past week, he gets in and out of his break like a little guy. And that's something that's it's just a testament to his hard work and his ability that he has. And playing in a system in Pittsburgh with Big Ben, and you have Juju Smith-Schuster as a number one, I think he's going to continue to get a lot of one-on-one coverage. And if I'm a fantasy player or if I'm just a fan of Chase Claypool, I think this would be a great week for him to go out and ball out again, because the Cleveland Browns, if you look at their injury list, is filled with a bunch of guys in the secondary. So if Juju can get it going, that's going to leave one-on-one for Chase Claypool. And, man, this guy could – he might have another 3 or 4 touchdown game, you know, just depending on how the coverage rolls. But right now he's really making a name for himself, and I'm happy for the kid.
Yeah, it's a great story indeed, without question. I got a couple of other games worth talking about before we let you go here, Tori, on this week's calendar. Carolina Panthers riding a 3-game winning streak. They're going back to Charlotte. Been impressive recently. But the Chicago Bears, and they had that kind of, you know, unusual win against Tampa Bay in the midweek game. But they're 4-1. And we look at this Bears team and Nick Foles, and there's a lot of people just figure it's only a matter of time before they come back to earth. But 4-1, 5 weeks into the NFL season, is indeed 4-1. Charlotte at home has got to be a favorite in this one. But what do you think of the Bears and this matchup in particular?
Oh, I love the Bears in this matchup. This is right here is for people that really get caught up in I guess names or whatever. At the end of the day, defense wins championships, and Chicago still has a top 10 defense in the NFL. I don't believe in Teddy Two Gloves, Teddy Bridgewater. You know, he's a solid guy. He has a great story, but when it comes to playing quarterback, the verdict is still out on him. And I just think with Khalil Mack and the defenders of Chicago, I think they're going to raise a lot of hell and make it extremely difficult for the Panthers to get going. And I can see the Bears going down to Charlotte and handling business against the Panthers just because of that front seven and the secondary. I mean, these guys are extremely talented, and the Panthers just haven't beat anyone. You know, you beat up on an Atlanta team that hasn't won a game, and I think they beat the Raiders early in the season. So it's not like they went out and beat some juggernauts, and I think on Sunday they're gonna get punched in the mouth.
I got to ask you about San Francisco, because you know they've lost a couple in a row to the Eagles and then to the Dolphins, both at home. Got a tough one this Sunday night against the Rams, also at home. Garoppolo gets benched, I would say, last week, even though you know there's some talk about it was to protect him because he came back from the ankle issue. But they signed him to that big deal. To me, he doesn't really look like a franchise guy who can necessarily lead you for years and years and win Super Bowls, even though they got close last year. What do you make of where they are? I know they've got injuries, but are you concerned, and are you especially concerned about Garoppolo?
Yeah, his confidence is gone, and you can see it by the play calling of Kyle Shanahan. Kyle Shanahan loves explosive plays. You know, I played in his offense in Cleveland once upon a time, and also if anyone can think about the Atlanta Falcons in the Super Bowl when they were up 28-3, that was Kyle Shanahan as offensive coordinator. I mean, this guy really know how to draw up plays and get, you know, players in space, you know, Julio Jones or whoever. So with him doing the same in San Francisco with all the talent they have, it really shows that he doesn't believe in Jimmy G. You know, this guy, literally, if Kyle Shanahan had a chance to throw the ball every play, he would. And with him not believing in Jimmy, not only does it affect the morale of Jimmy as an individual, but it hurts the team because they know, like, man, this guy is just not getting it done for us. And I would stay away from the San Francisco 49ers. If anyone have them on any survival pool picks or bet picks or anything like that, I would take the Rams in this game, because Sean McVay is one of the best offensive minds in football, and the way Jared Goff is playing offensively, and Aaron Donald for the L.A. Rams, the way they're getting after it, I can't back a quarterback like Jimmy G right now. He's too erratic, and I just can't. I would be pissed off on Sunday if I'm sitting there waiting on the San Francisco 49ers to get a win for me. I'd rather just stay away from that game or just take the Rams, because at least you know you're getting a team that's been more consistent and has looked better throughout the season, because I don't think they're going to be able to get it done tomorrow.
Well, Torrey, before we let you go then, let's say, never mind a survivor pool, if you're in a pool as to who's going to get the first win, you got the two New York teams in great competition. They both look abysmal. They're both on the docket. Washington is in New York to play the Giants, and the Jets are in Miami. But of the two New Yorks, 0-5, who is your disaster pool survivor in this? Who gets the first win?
I'm going to tell you this. I don't think neither gets a win. And even if they played each other, I think the game would be so bad it would end up in a tie. So I don't think neither team is going to win a game this year. I don't know what's going on with Adam Gase, but as of now, there's a lot of smoke and there's a lot of fire about him being out of New York pretty soon. And same thing with the Giants. You know, they just brought in a new coach. And David, you know what? I'll take the Giants to win first. And the reason why I say that, I did watch that Dallas game, and they should have beat Dallas. I had them projected to win, and the Giants lost that game. Dallas didn't win. The Giants lost. So I think they'll be able to squeak out a win eventually. So I'll take the Giants in that bit.
All right. Maybe it's this week at home against Washington. We shall see. Torrey Gurley, former NFL wide receiver, NFL analyst, co-host of the Champions Club podcast, joining us to talk some week six here today. Torrey, great to have you on the show. Thanks for your insight.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Torrey Gurley joining us. Great stuff on the NFL. Update now on the NLCS. So the Braves give up three runs. Freed gives up a couple of back-to-back home run scenario, and then a couple of hits to allow the third run. Josh, top of the second, the Braves load the bases with nobody out and don't score. They're now in the bottom of the second. Dodgers up 3-0. Still early, but boy, that couldn't be a worse start for the Braves. Well, yeah, it could be. They could have given up 11 runs in the first inning, but another bad start for the Braves.
Not getting anything, bases loaded, nobody out. I understand it was against the bottom of the lineup, and what can you necessarily expect with a pitcher like Buehler? But Nick Markakis, who's been a great hitter for a long time, swung the bat once, otherwise looked at five pitches and looked at almost 100, but more or less right there in the middle, didn't swing at it. You know, you struck out twice and then hit a ground ball. You can't say that the game's over in the second inning, but to not get for sure one, if not two, in that situation, it's going to be, I would be stunned at this point if you see the Braves mount much more. And yeah, maybe could you imagine if we end up getting Astros Dodgers, which would be a rematch of the 2017 World Series, which, you know, obviously the Astros won, but they cheated. And it was on the heels of the second team being the Astros to come back from 3-0 joining the Red Sox. And 3-1 is no joke either. I don't know the exact number, but it's not very high in the course of best of seven histories in the Major League Baseball playoffs. That would be something else. On top of all the other storylines, if you have those two teams playing the World Series coming off of unprecedented historic type comebacks, just another layer of juicy drama.
Oh, it would be fantastic if it is Dodgers Astros. I think the World Series is going to be great no matter what, but everything you just outlined is so true. And then when you take it, imagine if we'd even suggested on Wednesday or Thursday night that the Dodgers and Astros was going to be a possibility, the way both these series started, with the Braves up 2-0 and the Rays up 3-0. But that's where we are. Through two now, Dodgers lead the Braves 3-0. And coming up on Sportsnet Radio Network, 8 o'clock pregame show, Game 7, Tampa Bay Rays and the Houston Astros. Can the Astros complete the comeback or not? Can the Buffalo Bills get back on track after a real disappointing effort in their week 5 game after four brilliant weeks from Josh Allen and company? We'll talk about that in moments as Sportsnet Today continues with Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network, I'm Roger LeJoie and Josh Goldberg, and we're with you until 8 o'clock Eastern. Dodgers up on the Braves 3-0, one out top of the bottom of the third inning as the Dodgers and Braves go at it, and the Rays and the Astros will go at it in Game 7, as we just talked about what a World Series that would be if both the Dodgers and Astros crawl out of 3-0 and 3-1 deficits and meet after that whole garbage banging scandal, cheating scandal of the Astros. But we shall see. There is lots of baseball still to be played. In a moment, we'll be joined by Kevin Massari. He's the co-host of the Crowd Assist podcast. Talk to him about the Bills, who had just the dream start, Josh. And did they get exposed a bit in Week 5, or is that just a blip? They're going to lose at some point, right?
I would have been surprised if they went 16-0, but I wouldn't say it's a blip defensively. I understand they had two crucial injuries to White and Milano on the defense, and those are arguably their two best playmakers on defense. But the defense has been bad all year. There's just been an ocean of open space over the middle of the field, and you can beat them over the middle. The run D just hasn't really been there so far. And for a team that's identity has been defensive oriented for a couple of years now, it's been pretty surprising. It's been great that Josh Allen's taken that leap and been more explosive, and it's covered for some of those losses. But when you have a team like Tennessee who didn't send a ton of extra blitz pressure at Allen, were able to get to him effectively without throwing the house at him, you know, John Brown being out, I think, hurt a little bit. It was just injuries, but also I think I would be at least mildly concerned about the defense. I want to see an improvement and fast, but it's not going to be easy because, you know, Kansas City is Kansas City.
Kevin Massari joins us now, co-host of the Crowd Assist podcast, to talk about it. Kevin, thanks for joining the show. Hope you and yours are safe and well. Is there a reason to be especially concerned about this Bills defense as we head into a matchup against Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs, who, of course, a quarterback and a team that is notorious for making teams not playing very good defense pay a stiff price?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you have Patrick Mahomes come to town, it's going to be a challenge. You know, league MVP, come off the Super Bowl. You know, you have some things working in your favor, though, with some injuries. They're missing their number two receiver in Sammy Watkins, a guy Bills fans know fairly well. He can never seem to stay healthy. So that's a knock. They're going to have to play Mecole Hardman, a very up and down type of speed receiver that they don't like to throw the ball to a lot for his talent level. So he's just still meshing with Patrick Mahomes, as well as DeMarcus Robinson, a guy who's just a run-of-the-mill receiver. So there is concerns there, and obviously, you know, Clyde Edwards-Helaire is a running back, and you know, now he has Le'Veon Bell looking over his shoulder. So we'll see how that plays out over the course of the week. But, you know, anytime you have Patrick Mahomes come to town and what he's able to do is a concern, especially when you see the Bills struggle against Ryan Fitzpatrick, Ryan Tannehill, even a little bit against poor Sam Darnold offense at points during that game as well, week one. So there's definitely some concerns defensively, but you can't keep Sean McDermott down very long before he finally figures it out. And advanced statistics would tell you that their pass rush has been much better than some of the figures you have there. So there's some favorable matchups, and obviously Casey's coming, traveling all the way to Buffalo. And so I think that there's at least some type of hope that you're going to be able to slow down Patrick Mahomes.
I guess I'm curious what has been most alarming to you about the way the defense has played. Is there anything in particular that you look at and say, ooh, that stands out to me, and I have some concern whether they can really get that turned around enough?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to happen with the strength of usually the Bills team, especially from this beginning of Sean McDermott's era, was the defensive backfield has been struggling mightily. They've been really strong against the run. They had a game plan specifically geared to stop Derrick Henry last week, and it was. And just the Titans threw the ball really effectively, had the field position four times inside the 30. There's not much you can do with that. So although the numbers are very skewed, you had four big plays that really changed the game defensively for the Bills, and it's kind of a little skewed. The Bills outscored the Titans, out-yardaged the Titans. So there is some weird some things going on there, but it's definitely a defensive backfield. Last week you were missing your number one and number two corners. Taron Johnson, their nickel cornerback, has specifically struggled mightily in times. He's got the highest completion percentage against him. He's allowed the most catches and I believe the most yards as well. So he struggled a lot out of the slot for the Bills. They're going to need to make a change, and a name you could watch out for is University at Buffalo ex-cornerback Cam Lewis, undrafted free agent that they have that they might need to make the switch to this week, even with Trey White playing. Most likely he should be in the lineup as a full practice today. So that's the number one thing is the defensive backfield is struggling. They're struggling in man. They're struggling in soft zones. They haven't been very good across the field. So that's the number one thing that Sean McDermott works with. So I'd have to imagine that a correction comes and that they're able to figure that out, especially with the number one and maybe one of the best corners in the week suiting up this week.
Kevin Massari with us, co-host of the Crowd Assist podcast, Roger Lajoie and Josh Goldberg with you. Kevin, Josh Allen was the story of the first 4 weeks of the NFL season and still is when you take a look at it heading in and the quarterback comparison. I think if you had said by the time the Chiefs and the Bills would be playing that Josh Allen would have more passing yards and more touchdown passes than Patrick Mahomes, you could have got a good dollar on that bet. But that is still the case despite the fact that Allen had a rougher game against Tennessee. Quarterback rating was way down and, you know, had a couple of picks, only had one in the first four games. We talked about, look, no one's going 16-0, especially this year's Bills. The Tennessee game, you kind of write it off. We already talked about the defense, but there is an expectation that Josh Allen and this offense at some point is going to come back to more normal. Do you subscribe to that? What is your level of confidence, let's say, if this game does become a bit of a shootout against Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs? I think a lot of people before this season would have said, well, of course the Chiefs are going to win. A little bit more doubt now the way the Bills' offense has performed. But did you see anything against Tennessee that makes you think, all right, you know what, maybe it is going to regress a little more to the norm here?
No, I mean, I think what you can say, as I've said this on my show, is that the Bills might be, and I think gearing toward being an offensive team right now, and maybe going forward. Their offense is very strong. I think what happened in the Tennessee game was you saw a lot of zone coverage, a lot of looks for Josh Allen to sit back there, make a decision, make the right decision. Don't come after him because he's been very good against the blitz. He's been good against man coverage, especially with his talented receivers. And they said, you know what? If you wanted the Tom Brady and to take 7 yards at a time, we're going to let you do that. And you saw that in the second half where he was taking those throws pretty much that entire third quarter and then made one greedy throw. He even tells you himself, they didn't fool me with the coverage. You know, they dropped into a cover three. It was nothing there that I've never seen before. I got greedy and I made that throw. I was hoping that Malcolm Butler would jump on the short route, and he didn't, and he actually, you know, dropped off to play Gabe Davis. So I think he was getting greedy. He was getting a little impatient, you know, big play quarterback right now. So I'm very confident in the offense's ability to match up with Patrick Mahomes. And to me, a defense that's not great. The Titans were actually going in with limited defensive statistics as well. They played a really good game. They kind of had that mantra of everybody's against us, that Houston Astros type of mentality. So, you know, maybe it was a perfect storm for the Bills that go up there missing, you know, three or four key players of both sides of the ball. I think the Bills saw how much John Brown means to this roster, as well as, you know, you can't state what Trey White can do to you, especially with them really only have A.J. Brown on the other side of the field. That would have been a huge addition, as well as Matt Milano, who could have been able to cover their tight end a little bit better. So, yeah, I ultimately, had those players played and they still are a little disappointing, I'd be a little bit more concerned with their performance. All things considered, I mean, even Sean McDermott, who's mild-mannered himself, came out and wasn't really happy with the NFL solution to the whole COVID situation that surrounded their team, as well as having to push this game to Monday. So Kansas City does get an extra day of rest, 8 days of rest going into this game where the Bills have five. So it's really some unfortunate set of circumstances there. But I'm really excited to see the offense perform in this game. They are missing one of their rookie cornerbacks, isn't going to be able to play in this game, as well as obviously, you know, the Kansas City's offensive injuries are missing a starting guard as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see the defense be able to perform in this. And I like to look at it like this. They're going to let Kansas City run the ball, in my opinion. Total reverse from last week's game plan where they kind of got off guard with Ryan Tannehill. I think they're going to let Edwards-Helaire give him his yards and then do anything they can to maybe drop a little bit more into coverage, a little bit more than they did against Tennessee. So I think you're going to see a little bit more of that mush rush, which is three guys rushing after him and maybe a fourth guy coming after Patrick Mahomes. But they're going to stay back there in zone, make sure his legs don't beat you, as well as pay extra attention to Travis Kelce, as well as Tyreek Hill. So I think that's going to be their game plan. Those actually blitzed more than any other team in the NFL right now, so it hasn't been getting home. So I'd like to see them back that off a little bit, especially against Patrick Mahomes, a guy that can really make you pay. So I think doing kind of what Tennessee did to you, putting that, and then watching that Vegas film where Vegas really played a great defensive game plan against Mahomes. There are some things to be looking forward to with the Bills' defensive side of the ball, especially if you're going to get back Trey White and Matt Milano. One can cover Tyreek Hill, the other can cover Travis Kelce. So two huge components to this game, and if they're playing, I feel a lot better about the football game on Monday.
You know, the run game hasn't been particularly good this year. I think they're averaging under 4 yards a carry as a team. And Josh Allen has 3 of the 4 touchdowns on the ground, which is come to be expected. That's sort of what he does in that goal-to-go situation. But, you know, Singletary, 3.9 yards a carry, hasn't looked particularly good. You know, what have you made of his first 5 games? And is it, you know, imperative that Zach Moss, the rookie, gets back in the lineup so they can have that duo that they envisioned when they drafted him, kind of that thunder and lightning?
Yeah, I mean, you have to imagine the Bills really force-fed Moss in a lot of situations in week one and week two. And to me, Moss didn't look quite as explosive as I was expecting. Devin Singletary came in and took the league a little bit by storm, if you want to say that, in his first few weeks. I specifically remember against the Giants last year. He didn't get that explosiveness out of Moss. But the running game's been struggling in general. I saw footage of the Tennessee game where they ran into a 5-man box, which is unheard of. Just limited people on the line of scrimmage, and the Bills got like 3 yards on that play. The zone run didn't end up getting there, so it was a struggle in the running game, and I think Brian Daboll would tell you that himself. But yeah, I mean, the Bills had this weird thing around Singletary in the offseason, and then you saw that this week with the Bills' very entertaining Le'Veon Bell. To me, shows you that, well, they knew Moss is coming back this week, so, and they're still entertaining Le'Veon Bell as a final three team on Bell's list, if you want to say that. To me, it shows something's going on with Singletary. Either he's hurt, they don't like what they see out of him, he's not hitting the hole, he's not being very good in film room. I couldn't tell you, but there's something behind the scenes happening with the Bills' run game, specifically to Devin Singletary, and their inability to run the ball right now. So we'll see them force-feed Zach Moss for sure this coming Monday. And we're going to have to hope that it does a whole lot better seeing when Moss has been out. So to me, it can't get a ton worse. So we're talking about getting back to the mean. We're expecting that to go back to the mean, as the Bills have always been a pretty efficient running team. And I'd like to see Devin Singletary get there. But his snaps might get a little more limited here with Moss coming back, and the effectiveness of T.J. Yeldon in the passing game as well. So we'll see if they activate all three running backs here on Monday, or if something happens, goofy happens, but the Bills need to mix it up. So does that mean sitting Singletary for a game? I wouldn't do something like that, but I wouldn't be shocked to see the Bills make a move where it's Moss and T.J. Yeldon in the lineup at some point. So we'll have to monitor the situation closely and see what they do. But I don't think you can take Yeldon out of the lineup right now with as well as he's played, especially in a limited role.
Interesting. And Kevin, finally, before we let you go, this has been a much anticipated, hyped match just because of the way Josh Allen and the Bills started the year offensively. Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs are the industry standard, the defending champions. Yet it was supposed to be on a Thursday night. It was the centerpiece game. It's still on a Monday, but it's 5:00. The Bills are coming off their worst performance of the year. It is still, obviously, in terms of AFC, pecking order, power ratings, a crucial game. Both teams are 4-1, but did the fact that it get bumped a little bit kind of diminish that just a little bit, or does it really still have the significance of this might be the biggest game of the year for the Bills, even though it's week 6?
I think it honestly, I couldn't say that it hasn't lowered that, diminished that value of this game. You're talking about a game that's 2:00 Pacific, 4:00 Central. It just doesn't have that zing that it should, especially for the primetime matchup that it was going to be with two primetime quarterbacks who, with Dak Prescott's injury, should be close to 1-2 in passing yardage, or close to it after this week. And Josh Allen might actually take that over as the top passing quarterback in this league after this week. We'll have to monitor that. But, yeah, it does take the zing out of it a little bit. You have to imagine this game would have been watched by everybody, you know, a couple of 4-1 squads going at it, even without any dogs in the fight, a lot of fantasy players going for each squad. you'd have to imagine that there's not that zing anymore where someone in Los Angeles isn't going to be able to take off of work to watch the Bills-Chiefs game. So it is a bummer, but you got to remember that the internal clock for the Chiefs is going to be around 3 p.m. In this specific 2 or 3 p.m. for them. That's a weird time to play a football game with your mental clock. So there are definitely some factors here in this game that could gear toward the Bills with that West to East Coast travel. Doesn't usually go well statistically for the traveling squad. So there are some intangible differences in this game that will help the Bills out as compared to the Titans game, where really nothing was going their way with scheduling, with rosters, with anything. They had gotten back some players in time too. So this game is going to, you know, some of those intangibles might swing back to the Bills in this one with some of that travel and that internal clock. So although it does lose that zing of that primetime matchup, it's still a very big game for the Bills. It's really large in tie-breaking scenarios because it's really a game and a half to two games in the standings. You take a win out of this, and you're in really good shape, not only for the division, but at least a final two spot. So it has a lot of pepper in this game, and you have to go and say that the Bills are going to – did they look ahead to the Chiefs game, guys? That's something you have to kind of wrap your head around last week. Did Sean McDermott actually have two game plans ready like they originally sat and kind of backtracked on? I think it's very possible that the Bills are looking for this and saying, hey, we're missing some of our key players in the Titans game. Let's go at home and win a really important Chiefs game. I think that's something to think about.
It is an important game in the standings. There is no question, even though it's Monday at 5 o'clock instead of the original Thursday. But a lot of eyes will be on Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs as they take on the Buffalo Bills tomorrow. And Sportsnet 590, The Fan, of course, your home for Buffalo Bills action, starting with next Sunday's game as usual. So we look forward to that as well. Kevin Massari is the co-host of Crowd Assist Podcast, joining us to talk some Bills. Kevin, appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kevin Massari joining us from Crowd Assist Podcast. It is the game of the year for the Bills in terms of, and when you want to look at legitimacy this year, Josh, you have to fight New England off still to win the division. Cam Newton and the Patriots have been decent. And, you know, Torrey Gurley, when he joined us, really likes the Patriots. So they're still going to win some ball games. But end of the day, Kansas City is your measuring stick, is how good you are of winning a playoff game or two or three. So I look forward to Monday's game.
Oh, it's going to be good. Yeah, it's a disappointment that obviously you can't have any fans there. Even 20% of Bills fans for that kind of game, you know, would have been a Thursday night, or now is a Monday early evening game. Still probably would have added a little bit of atmosphere, but you know, there's a decent possibility that the Bills just get boat raced in that game because the defense just hasn't shown anything. They got shredded by Ryan Tannehill last week for 42 points, and he had daylight to throw to and had tons of time. It was just not a good performance at all. And Mahomes doesn't need all that time. He can, you know, make a throw on the run. He can make throws with pressure in his face. And if the Bills don't get creative and aren't relentless defensively, then you're going to need to win a game, you know, maybe 45-41. And perhaps they can do that. I just find it unlikely that that's going to be the case. And if John Brown doesn't play again, their offense just doesn't have the same bite. He just really takes the top off that defense and allows everything else to fall into place. And it sounds like he's kind of up in the air, maybe going to play, maybe not. And it would be a good litmus test if they could just keep this thing really competitive and play a good ball game into the fourth quarter, even if they don't lose. You just don't want to have a situation where you just get crushed or embarrassed, and then everyone just says, well, you know, the Bills are who we thought they were, same old Bills. Maybe they win the division, maybe they get a wild card spot, but they're not a Super Bowl contender.
I think a solid performance is very important in this game for the Bills. You're right about that. Josh Goldberg, Roger Lajoie, reach us on Twitter at jgoldberg12, at the Raj 590. Text us 590-590. Name and location, please. We'll tee up our next 2 hours with you and get you up to date on the Dodgers and Braves and more as Sportsnet Today continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
When the rains came down in the hollow, playing a new game. Laughing and a running, hey, hey. Skipping and a jumping. In the misty morning fog with all our hearts are thumping. And you, my brown eyed girl.
Sportsnet today in the Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you until 8 o'clock Eastern. That's when we go to Game 7 of the American League Championship Series. Tampa Bay Rays, Houston Astros. Can the improbable, almost impossible comeback be finished off? We may be asking ourselves the question of the LA Dodgers the same way. They're in the top of the fourth inning, one out. Dodgers lead the Braves 3-0. Runner on for Atlanta. And Josh, we're going to see a game 7 in this series, maybe.
Yeah, I think we are. I go back to that second inning, and you can't leave that situation without any runs. You probably had to score two, but to leave with zero is just, you know, you had Buehler up against the ropes, and he steadied the ship a little bit again. He's only at, you know, 57 pitches right now. And, you know, they've got a couple on here in the fourth inning, so, you know, maybe they can get something going here. But, yeah, this has been, outside of, I guess, game 5, the Dodgers scored all those runs in the first inning of game 3. And then they scored 3 in the first inning here of game 6. Their bats just haven't really been there, which has been a little bit of a surprise. But it's obviously hard to score runs. The runs are at a premium in the playoffs. And as long as they can find ways to just make those runs hold up, they're in good shape. And that's certainly not the worst recipe. If you score early and then stop scoring, when you have a good rotation and a great bullpen, you can win a lot of ball games. But I'm sure Dodgers fans are hoping that they can start to score some runs consistently outside of the first inning or one or two big innings here or there.
That will be interesting to see. And you're right about the Dodgers' offense. Is it a matter of time? And you would think in 2020, at some point, this Dodgers team will break through and make the big comeback and win a World Series. We shall see. Lots of baseball to go, though. Two on, as you said. One out, top of the fourth. Dodgers lead the Braves 3-0 in Game 7 of Astros and Rays coming up at 8 o'clock. But between then and now, Josh and I will still be with you in our 6 o'clock Eastern hour. Javon Shepherd joins us, basketball analyst, CBS Sports. He's also the co-host of the Gym Rats and Joints podcast. We'll wrap up the NBA season with him. Eric Patterson has golf coverage at The Score, and we'll talk to him about the PGA Tour. And we'll get you ready for the game with some pregame comments from the principals of the Rays and the Astros coming up. You want a comment? We'd love to hear from you. Email the show, Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Text 590-590. Name and location, please, if you're texting 590-590. And on Twitter, at TheRog590 is where I am, and at Jay Goldberg is where you find Josh. Josh Goldberg, Roger Lajoie. Sportsnet tonight continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
It all happens in real time. Don't be the last to know. Listen here first. Sportsnet today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Tonight on the Sportsnet Radio Network, I'm Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg, as we transition from Sportsnet Today into Sportsnet Tonight. And great to be with you here for another couple hours, because we're getting you ready for the American League Championship Series between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Houston Astros. The NLCS is underway right now with the Dodgers up 3-0 in the bottom of the fourth inning. So there may be a seventh game in that series. And if there is, we'll have it for you tomorrow night. Josh, we talked all day about Game 7, the two best worlds in sports. I don't have any really cheering teams I'm cheering for in this. I like the long series. I like the drama. I say bring it on. And even though I still don't think a baseball game needs to be four and a half hours long, at least in the postseason, the games are of significance. that you can still enjoy them. So I look forward to this, and the Dodgers are certainly doing their part to have another Game 7.
What do you think it is about playoff postseason baseball that the length of game seems to increase by, you would think, at least a half hour, if not more? You don't have very many nine-inning, four-plus-hour baseball games in the regular season. You might get a couple a season, but not that many. It's a regular occurrence. I don't mind it because I love baseball and it's the postseason, so I'm going to watch. But is it, I guess, more quick pitching changes? I guess guys are grinding out at bats. It's always been one that just, I don't know, are guys taking longer between pitches and it isn't being enforced? I don't totally understand how we all of a sudden have nine-inning ball games going from 2 hours and 55 minutes or so to like 3:35 or longer.
Taking longer between pitches, I would put it number one because of the importance of it. Even guys who are usually quick workers are taken all day. And numerous pitching changes, and what drags out a ball game, and this comes from my experience as an official scorer, Josh, because I noticed I time the games in the regular season, in-inning pitching changes really add to the time of a game. When you're bringing in a guy, giving a batter, you know, a pitcher now, you got to get at least three batters faced. But, you know, I think that's what it does. But even with no crowds and all the other trappings that made it so exciting and you think dragged it out, it's just, it does take too long. But I am not complaining either. Listen, I do love the postseason baseball. But you're right, the postseason game is much longer than even the already too long regular season games. But bring it on tonight. 8 o'clock pregame starts, and we'll have it for you on the Sportsnet Radio Network. The NBA season has wrapped up. There's a league that knows how to play its games in a neat, tidy 2 hours and 15 minutes to 2 hours and 20 minutes all the time. But it's done for this season, and to review and talk about the offseason and the ramifications of what we saw, Javon Shepherd, basketball analyst, fine one for CBC Sports and the host of the Gym Rats and Joints podcast. Javon, thanks very much for being with us. And, well, it wraps up the season with LeBron James winning the title for the Los Angeles Lakers, his fourth championship. Javon, we can't speak for LeBron. We can't speak for any of the players. But how does a in-the-bubble COVID championship, you think, compare to other ones, not just for him, but for everybody involved?
You know what? I think this championship will be one of the most iconic and go down in history just because, you know, if you take away the basketball, there's so much that, you know, that the NBA encompasses, NBA accomplished, just executing this bubble seamlessly. And again, the protests, the, you know, there's just so much that went on. So this one is definitely memorable, and it's going to hold a lot of weight going forward. So I'm happy for LeBron. I'm happy for the Lakers tremendously.
So I got to ask you, there's been obviously anytime LeBron does anything good or bad in the playoffs, it always is, well, how does it affect his perch among the greats, and how does it affect the conversation with Michael Jordan? And I just feel like at this point, that's sort of a hopeless conversation. It is what it is. And I feel like we should be talking about greatest of the era. I saw Chris Long, Kyle Long, the football player, was tweeting that. And I think that's a great argument. Comparing players from different eras, like three-point shooting wasn't at a premium when Jordan played the way it is now. They're different players. Just let's have a conversation about greatest players of an era. I know it's not going to be the case, but it just seems counterproductive to always be measuring up players from different eras.
You know what? That conversation is just going to continue to go in circles because, one, you're dealing with different eras, different rules. The league has changed. The style of play has changed. And then, secondly, we all have different equalizers, right? So if you're, you know, a lot of people have measured Michael Jordan by his championships. Now, if you're measuring it by statistics, LeBron takes the edge. If he gets six championships, then he's, you know, for me, he becomes, if we have to have that conversation, the greatest of all time. But again, I grew up watching Michael Jordan. So he was the first superhero that I knew. And you can't have that conversation. There's too layered. There's too many variables that go into it. And again, it depends on your equalizer.
Well, agreed. And I won't continue that conversation for long, except to add one thing. One thing we can always compare, fellas, is, yeah, well, you can't compare Jordan to James to Bill Russell, for heaven's sakes, but you can compare how a certain athlete compared in his era. And hear me out on this. You know, I mean, so everyone said, well, you can't compare Gretzky to players who played in the 50s because the game was more offensive-minded. Very good point. Mm-hmm. But you can also say that Wayne Gretzky had 1,000 more points than anybody else who ever played hockey. So if it was that easy to score, why didn't anybody else do it? Babe Ruth, you can't compare Babe Ruth because of the errors, the ball. Granted, the year he hit 61 homers, I think the runner-up had 26. You know, that you can compare. And I think when we talk about LeBron James, even though stay away from Jordan, just what James has done by being in 10 of 11 finals, winning four, winning four MVPs in the playoffs, will eventually be the leading scorer in the history of basketball. He sticks around another couple of years. He's going to catch Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We can compare that. And so I don't care about Jordan versus James, but James, from what we're seeing now, and I watched that last game, and I'm looking at this guy going, this is one of the greatest players of all time. And I can leave it at that and leave it alone because, my goodness, he's something special, Javon.
You can rest easy with that. And again, you know, James is somebody that he's not the most skilled player, but athletically, the specimen that we're seeing, we're not going to see something like that again. He stands at 6'8", but 250 all muscle, and he's a freight train in transition. So, you know, I think when I watch LeBron, the thing that's most impressive about me is his IQ level and his ability to, you know, facilitate and get his guys involved. No, he's not going to be the best scorer on your team, natural scorer, but he does so many other things on the court that allows him to score, allows him to dominate the game. And I know he took flack, you know, a lot of criticism in game five when he had made that pass to Danny Green. And I'm looking and I'm listening, I'm watching some of the criticism, and I'm saying, guys, the ability to make that pass is the reason why this guy is in the conversation of greatness. He had four players on him, double teamed, help side, and, you know, helped come across from Bam to block the shot. Not a lot of players are going to be able to make that play, period. So, you know, you just have to commend him for not only, you know, his natural ability, but a guy that's his work ethic. I mean, 2 days after the championship, he's right back in the gym and putting in the work and the hours. And that's the thing that people don't really see and take into account when they're having the conversations of greatness.
So, you know, looking at their roster, expectation is Anthony Davis will be back on probably a short-term deal. They have plenty of other free agents, KCP, Rondo. But it seems like, you know, they'll have some flexibility either to bring back their own guys or go out there and use, you know, mid-level exception, et cetera, to try and bring in more players. You think heading into whenever next season starts, however long it is, you have to look at them as the prohibitive favorites to repeat and win another championship?
You definitely do. One, you have the best player in the world right now, and then you have you're going to end up with the best big man in the league or in the world again. So I think, you know, given that and given that they're coming off a championship season and now that they're able to build some more chemistry and grow on what they've done this year, they're definitely going to be, you know, the team to watch or the team that's, you know, at the head of this thing. But, you know, I think also going forward, the tough thing for a lot of these teams is the decision that they're going to have to make financially because, again, it's such uncertain times. There's no telling if there's even going to be fans in the 2021 season, which obviously has financial implications and salary cap uncertainty. So as for some of the other teams that are making moves, do you save a bit this year not knowing what's going to happen next year, or do you know, go full throttle in, you know, in a free agency that doesn't really have, you know, the stars to the players that 2021 may have or 2019 had? So given all that, I think they're definitely going to be the premier team and team to look out for.
Very uncertain times in the NBA and all of sports, and we'll see how the ramifications go with the NBA. One thing we were deprived of this year, Javon, and I will use the word deprive, is that matchup we all wanted to see between the Clippers and the Lakers in the Western Conference Final. And although the Lakers celebrate with good reason, and I agree with both you and Josh, I think they should be considered favorites again. We did not see that matchup against the Clippers that a lot of people thought the Clippers had more than a decent chance of winning. And the ramifications and end of day from that is now we're getting rumblings of some Clippers maybe didn't like the preferential treatment Kawhi got in the load management in the same way that they did the Raptors embraced when they won the championship. They made a coaching change, obviously. So now they bring in Tyronn Lue, who knows high pressure situations with generational players, coaching him and trying to navigate through that. Is that a better fit for the Clippers? And never mind our expectations of the Lakers perhaps defending as NBA champions, do we expect the Clippers to perform better in the postseason next year as a result? And where do they go moving forward?
I think, you know, with the Clippers, it's just a rebrand. I don't think it had anything to do with Doc Rivers or anything or the preferential treatment because, you know, when you have a star player like that, it comes with the territory. And again, you know, those guys, it's going to boil down to chemistry. I think the biggest thing that they were missing this year was a point guard that can actually facilitate and get guys where they need to be. You know, Patrick Beverley does a great job defensively, but I don't think he's an extension of your coach on the court. Whereas, you know, I think the difference will be Tyronn Lue is a little closer in age. He's a bit more relatable. I'm a fan favorite. I err on the edge of having a coach that's played before and a little younger so that he can relate to his players a bit more. Doc Rivers was a great motivator. I think he's a great coach. He's accomplished a lot. But I just think it was time for a change. It's time for, you know, a new look, a new face. He's had his time there. And Tyronn Lue will definitely do the job. He's surrounding himself with some good coaches. I've heard whispers of Chauncey Billups if he doesn't get the Indiana job. So, you know, just having, you know, players like that can command attention, can control and command the court and the respect of their players is going to speak volumes. I think they're a championship team right now, not necessarily, but we'll definitely see a competitive team going forward.
I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, a lot was made about bringing in Ty Lue and how he can hold guys accountable. And when he came in for David Blatt in Cleveland, he, you know, took LeBron to task on stuff and told LeBron mm-hmm. he needed to get in better shape. And, you know, mm-hmm. superstar players need that. Everyone needs that. But with the Clippers, you know, their franchise future being uncertain with beyond this year because Paul George and Kawhi are both potential free agents, is it a risk that, you know, if you rock the boat too much that, you know, maybe you could risk losing those guys altogether and setting back your franchise? Or do you just feel as though you got to change up the mix from last year and maybe these guys just need to be pushed and see what ends up happening at the end of next season?
The reality is they don't have the luxury of time on their hands because both those guys are up for in free agency in 2021 here. And You have to push them. You have to push them now. And winning solves everything. We've seen a lot of the stuff that we're hearing about Kawhi right now. We didn't have those problems in Toronto, here in Toronto. And that, again, was because of the success that we've had. So I think Tyronn Lue has a you know, a history of coming in and changing, you know, the way things are. And he did that with Cleveland, with LeBron, who's an even bigger star when he took over for Dave. And that was they ended up extremely successful. So, you know, going forward, he has that ability and that impact on guys, and I think you have to push right now. You have to put a little more gas on the pedal and force these guys to really see the big picture because, again, everybody, there's jobs on the line and everything's at stake going forward.
Javon Shepherd is with us from CBC Sports. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you. Sportsnet Today is where you take a look back at the NBA season, which ends with LeBron James and his fourth championship with the L.A. Lakers. So the two L.A. teams will remain big stories moving forward. The Eastern Conference, Javon, is extremely interesting because at the start of this playoffs, people were saying that, well, the Raptors are the defending champions, but they're going to be in tough. Giannis and the Bucks were the team that won the most games. Boy, the Sixers and the Celtics are tough. And lo and behold, it was the Miami Heat that almost won the NBA title and put up a great fight against the Lakers. What we saw in the playoffs, especially with the Heat, does that change your kind of power rankings, if I can phrase that, as to who we should expect to be top teams in the East when play resumes?
I don't think it changes that per se, but what I do appreciate and what I do commend the Miami Heat for is that they've shown that you don't need these super teams. You don't need the superstars. You need a team that has synergy from your president all the way down to, you know, your 15th man on the bench and just guys that are all on the same page. So, you know, that's a team that accomplishes everything they have by committee. And I think that's a message that needs to be relayed throughout the NBA and just, you know, breaking up these super teams and going forward with building a team, building, you know, strong teams from foundation up and just having an understanding that we have a common goal. And it's not, you know, guys are just coming in for one season and just jumping ship.
I'm curious, I got to get your thoughts on, you know, what happened in Houston. You know, Daryl Morey's out and mm-hmm. kind of the end of an era. I always liked the way he, you know, was straight up about how he wanted to build a team and was going to capitalize on market inefficiencies and change, I think, a lot of the way we look at asset management and how you build a team. I guess, what's the legacy of his time in Houston? They never got to a finals, never won a championship, but had a lot of success. And I think did a lot to change the way that we look at team building in the NBA.
Yeah, you know, he did a lot over there, and I'll say this. From a basketball component, I don't necessarily like the way they constructed that team. I wasn't a fan of the small ball, per se. I know Morel, he's, you know, a big analytics guy, and he really tried to change the way that we played the game, the NBA played the game. It didn't work out for him, but we can commend him for everything that he's accomplished, everything he's done, and just really, really reshaping that team. They're in a tough position, though. You know, you have a contract of Russell Westbrook, who's an aging player, a volume guy that's really, you know, he doesn't have as much value as he would have in the past. And then you don't really have valuable pieces to really, you know, move around or get back to a competitive team, I don't think, without a Harden that I've heard whispers of potentially moving. So it's going to take some years before that team is right on track. And obviously they've had talks of Jeff Van Gundy returning, you know, his first coaching stint since 2007, returning back to the Houston Rockets. But, you know, he did change the way the game was played. I wasn't necessarily a fan, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see where they go from here.
So, Javon, what about the Raptors now and their offseason? And we'll get into the whole NBA offseason, really, when it comes down to what we can expect. And we already kind of touched on it. But the Raptors in particular, you know, I mean, we'll see what Giannis eventually decides vis-a-vis the Bucks. That's going to change the landscape of the Eastern Conference. But there is no question, I already talked about the five teams, and let's throw the Nets in when Kevin Durant is healthy for them as well, that, you know, it was the least for many years. It was just whoever was LeBron was playing for was going to be in the final, and off you go. My goodness, not anymore. We got a lot of heavyweights. And for the Raptors to keep up with the Joneses and stay in that mix, do you like the way they are set up? We saw some of the flaws against the Celtics. They were unable to go over the top. Maybe Pascal did not do exactly what he needed to do to take his next step as a player. But talk about where you see the Raptors going in the direction of what is now an incredibly very competitive and quite good top six teams in the Eastern Conference.
You know what? I have a lot of trust in Masai, and I have a lot of trust in Bobby Webster. That have done an exceptional job in not only building the Raptors team, but development over the years. I also, you know, understand what's at stake and understand that the roster that we have. And I think, you know, we've had success in the last couple of years, and it's still going to take some patience to get back to where we were. You know, Pascal, again, he took a lot of criticism. And we've seen that early in the playoffs. But I think, you know, people forget that Pascal is a guy 2-3 years ago that was your third, fourth option on the same Raptors team. You know, the Raptors gave him a pretty big contract, and that was just to show, you know, we trust in you, we invest in you, this is a promise that we are going to continue to develop you. So I think, you know, we can't expect him to carry this team, you know, in next season or in this year as someone that I had expected, because he's not that player yet. He's continuing to develop. He's a guy that's started playing basketball late. And, you know, but the Raptors have done a really good job of developing guys. People don't know, a lot of people don't know that these guys have been in the G League, program, the Raptors 905 affiliate team, and they you know, Van Fleet and Pascal have won a championship with them. So their commitment to developing their guys, you know, I commend. So I see that it's going to take some time, but I think I am on the side of trusting, you know, the front office and what they're doing. And obviously we have some moves to make right now. With Van Fleet's contract up, Gasol and Ibaka up. So there's going to be some decisions to make. But again, you know, developing guys that have, you know, proven and had an impact, and they're going to continue to grow.
I know you are around and definitely doing some analysis for the Raptors 905. So I want to ask you about Paul Watson, because you talk about player development and the job that the Raptors have done, maybe as good as anyone in the NBA. Is for Paul Watson somebody to keep an eye on next year to step into the rotation and maybe open some eyes as a legitimate rotation piece on a good NBA team?
You know, it all depends on how the Raptors roster shapes up over this offseason. But I think as far as, you know, Paul Watson goes, he has a lot of intangibles, as well as O'Shea Brissett, that transfer over, whether it be from G League, college, or into the NBA game. You know, length is something that you can't teach. You know, his athleticism, and we've seen flashes from him. It's just really now putting it together and having that component of composure and just understanding the NBA game. So I think for him, it's going to be a learning curve. And I definitely see him as an NBA rotational player. Is he going to be a star tomorrow or in the next couple years, no. But he can be a guy that can play, can defend multiple positions and really have an impact on the game just so long as he continues to develop. And again, the Raptors have done a great job with that over the last couple of years, which is having, you know, one of the premier developmental teams in the NBA.
Will be fascinating to see how the Raptors react to the improvement of the Eastern Conference when the NBA season starts. And here's hoping it's sooner rather than later. But lots of question marks for both the NBA and the NHL. Javon Shepherd, basketball analyst, CBC Sports. Check out his podcast as well, Gym Rats and Joints. Joins us here on Sportsnet today. Javon, terrific stuff. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Javon Shepherd. Love him. From CBC Sports. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you. Update from the NLCS. Still 3-0. Dodgers going to the bottom of the fifth thanks to a terrific catch by Mookie Betts in right field. And, you know, Josh, if the Dodgers do come back, win this series, win the World Series, I'm sure fans of the Boston I can tell you fans of the Boston Red Sox will be very happy for Mookie Betts. But you talk about some anger there because he was the franchise in Boston, and he's already kind of the franchise in the Dodgers.
Yeah. Yikes. If I'm a Red Sox fan watching these playoffs unfold, knowing that I traded Mookie Betts for maybe some prospects who could be legitimate major leaguers, like maybe somebody makes an all-star game of that lot that they got. But the chances of all of those players turning anywhere near Verdugo, Wong, and Downs into Mookie Betts, 0%. It's never going to happen. Mookie Betts has more value going forward than all three of those players combined. It was an insane decision, cost-cutting, cheaping out when you're the Boston Red Sox. If you're a Jays fan, you got to be thrilled that Mookie Betts not only isn't in the division, he's out of the league altogether, so you're not going to have to see him because he tormented the Jays for his entire career as soon as he came up. But yeah, it's a not so bold strategy by the Dodgers, using your financial might to capitalize on an opportunity where a player was available. For some reason, you were able to get him above other teams who probably could have offered more, you would think. And then you lock him up to a 12 year extension through 2032. Probably going to be worth close to, if not every penny. That's why the Dodgers are the Dodgers. They have the money, but they're smart enough to realize when an opportunity like that comes around. They're smart on a lot of other things, and they're just the perfect hybrid of financial might and smart management.
The Dodgers may be the only one, too, Josh, that have taken to a completely different level, though. I mean, their payroll is $75 million ahead of anybody else. The Red Sox, Yankees, and certain other teams at certain other times used to spend money. The Dodgers just go out and do it. But back to the point of spending it wisely and getting the guy, and as a guy who spent a lot of time in Boston over the years, and I love that city, and I went to not just covering World Series and other events that I've been to the city for, Stanley Cup Finals, NBA Finals. I just love Boston. I go in the summer to watch the Red Sox. I know what Mookie Betts meant to Boston. That was just the wrong call. It just was the wrong call, the wrong guy. Unless you never know in negotiations. Maybe it's a case of, Mookie Betts had decided, I don't want to play in Boston anymore. And you never really know that for sure. And if that's the case, all right, you grin and bear it and you do it. But to your point, to only get guys that may be okay for him, and he's just at the start of his career, really. Well, start of his career, but prime of his career. It's not like he's 38, a slugging veteran. You let David Ortiz go, for heaven's sakes. So I agree with you. If I'm the Red Sox, I'm sitting back and I'm watching Mookie Betts, and they're going to be watching Mookie Betts for another decade in L.A., maybe longer.
Yeah, they're going to have a lot of great baseball. He could probably will win MVPs in the next couple of years, you would think, because he's that kind of player. He's already got one on his mantle. And, Bellinger didn't have the greatest year in the world, but, he's won the MVP last year, I believe. And having two MVPs in your lineup from both sides of the plate, occupying center and right field. And, maybe their rotation with Kershaw on the way out could be, a vulnerability going forward. But, they've got May and Julio Urias is there and Bueller. And if they need more starting
pitching,
they'll
just go get somebody else. That's my
they'll point. Trade or spend a whack of cash and bring somebody else. And it's great. It would be great to be a Dodgers fan. Let me tell you that much.
Yeah, they figure to be competitive for a long time to come. They're up 3-0, two outs, bottom in the fifth on the Braves, trying to force a game seven. We'll do some golf talk. And speaking of golf talk, too, the marriage between sports gambling and sports, and not just there's always been a marriage, they've always been bedfellows, but now it's even more formalized in terms of the coverage of sports, and golf has taken a step, significant step in that direction. We'll talk about that and more. Keep you up to date on the baseball as Sportsnet Tonight continues. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Tonight on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you until 8 o'clock Eastern. The American League Championship Series Game 7 is coming up on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Pre-game coverage at 8. We'll have a bit of a pre-game, Josh and I, between 7 and 8 p.m. We'll still be with you, and we'll play some of the pre-game comments of some of the principles of this game, as it could be an historic comeback for the Houston Astros. It already is, really. Coming back from 3-0 is only the second time that a team has even forced a seventh game. We'll see if they can close the deal. The Dodgers trying to close the deal against the Atlanta Braves, up 3-0, one on, two out, bottom of the fifth inning. And if we have a seventh game tomorrow, we'll have it for you here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Either way, Josh will be on with show between 12:30 and 4. I'll join you 4 until either baseball or Raceline Radio. And such is the nature, Josh. You never know during the season how many games are going to be played in a series, that is. But, boy, both teams might be going to the max, or both series might be going to the max here. I did not see that coming after the first couple of games.
Certainly not. And at this point, you talk about it's already a historic comeback. Got to finish the deal, right? Because then you talk about becoming the second team ever to do it, and then you're talking about history. It'll be such a disappointment. I don't know about to just casual baseball fans, because casual baseball fans hate the Astros, but to the Astros and their fans, it's great to get it to a game seven, but it's all moot if you don't end up coming back and finishing the deal.
Oh, I totally agree. It's like people who tell you it's better to lose early in the playoffs than lose in game seven of a Stanley Cup final or an NBA final. You went to all that effort and you didn't finish it off, and that's indeed the case. So we'll see if they can do it. Should be a lot of fun. Listen in starting at 8 o'clock. Listen in right now. Eric Patterson joins us. He's got golf coverage at the Score and the Score app as we talk about the PGA Tour, which is at Shadow Creek in the CJ Cup this weekend, round 3 in the books. Eric, thanks very much for being with us. And, you know, I guess we got to get our heads around the fact, Eric, sometimes, you know, you see, golf tournament and end of the season and middle of October, and what does it mean? It's like, if nothing else, these tournaments are previews and warm-ups for the Masters, which is in November. So the 2020 golf season certainly is a lot different, and significance of these events is a lot different.
Yeah, that's right. This is usually the sleepy season in the PGA Tour schedule, where they usually go to, they're in Asia, they go to China, South Korea, but obviously due to the pandemic, they are playing some primetime events right now leading up to a November Masters. So all around a very strange year, and some nice evening viewing right now as the guys are in Las Vegas with some pretty decent leaderboard shaping up for Sunday.
What have you made of Shadow Creek that we haven't seen it in years, I guess, outside of the match holding up for you?
I mean, we got a good taste of it at the match, but it is everything it's kind of talked up to be. It's this almost fantasy land in the middle of the desert. It looks more like a course you'd find down in like the Georgias or the Carolinas. There's pine trees, there's pine straw, there's waterfalls and rivers, and it looks nothing like a desert course, but it's from all accounts, it's in perfect condition. it rarely gets any play. But so when these tour pros show up, the fairways are pristine, the greens are immaculate. It's just it's a course like players like me and the average Joe out there will never ever get to see. But it is, you know, it's a nice opportunity to see it on TV, and it seems like it's given these guys a good test.
It's a fun event, despite the fact the test has been a good one, as you say. Some very impressive scores being posted along the way. So I said the warm-up for the Masters, but it's significant. Look, you're playing a tournament. Everybody wants to win a tournament. What do we read into players' play here on October 12th when the Masters is coming up in early November? And how significant an event do you think the guys are looking at this as?
I think it's a pretty important event for all these guys. There aren't that many competitive rounds left until Augusta. This course, actually, like I said, it seems like a venue you'd see in the Georgia, the Carolinas. So there are some characteristics about it that do resemble Augusta, the sloping fairways, the type of grass. So these guys are really taking this seriously. McIlroy alluded to it this week and next week as well. These will be the last two chances to warm up for the Masters. Usually their Masters prep is happening in Florida in like the month of March, and those are pretty big events to begin with. So they're kind of treating it with that same level of like intensity, I guess you could say, or preparation. Even though it is October, there's one of the biggest tournaments. I mean, the biggest tournament in golf is just around the corner. So a lot can be made from this week. There's some big names who are playing well and rounding into form. Brooks Koepka is back. Rory's playing well, so we get to see Tiger next week, so we'll see where his game is at as he goes in to try to defend his title at Augusta. So it's exciting time for golf, even though football and Major League Baseball playoffs are kind of taking the spotlight away.
So right now, Xander Schauffele is a shot off the lead of Russell Henley, and it looked like, you know, he was going to cruise, had a multiple shot lead headed into the weekend. And he's even today, and you know, he's won some big events and contended at majors, but it just seems like ever since the first event back after the restart, he missed a brutal putt, a lip out, and then lost in a playoff to Daniel Berger. And it seems like it maybe rattled his cage a little bit, and he hasn't had these opportunities. You know, what do you make of how he's been playing, and do you still like his chances the rest of this weekend and certainly heading towards Augusta, where he had a good finish last time around?
Yeah, I try not to bring any bias into my golf coverage, but I am a big Xander Schauffele fan. I think he's extremely well-rounded and typically flies under the radar. So, like, your average golf fan might not know too much about him, even though he is a top 10 ranked player in the world. So I do like his chances going in even into Sunday. If he holds his ground right now, he typically plays better from a chasing position, and maybe this is why you're seeing him struggle today. He's not generally the best front runner, so going into the weekend with a three-shot lead isn't his forte, I should say, but I would expect a rebound. Like you said, he's contended in a lot of majors, so even if he doesn't win this week, I would assume he's happy with his performance going into the Masters. You know, he's obviously playing pretty well. He actually shot the lowest 72-hole score at the Tour Championship, but didn't really get credited with the win because of the FedEx Cup playoff system. So that was more like a result that, again, kind of flies under the radar and didn't really get the credit he deserved.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, some golfers who are better known performing well in this tournament. Bubba Watson had a 65 today. Rory McIlroy, a 66. My goodness, you've got Jason Day, who's got two holes left on the last I looked at their leaderboard, who's got a shot at a 65 or 66. There are some guys, Justin Thomas is having a good round as well. There are some guys who have been around the golf world quite a while who are putting up some good numbers here. Bodes well for the kind of leaderboard we may see at Augusta when we get there.
Yeah, that's, again, that is something to be excited about this week. And, you know, with no cut, and there's only 78 guys in the field, the cream will start to rise to the top as, you know, as the week goes on. So that's why you're seeing this run from Bubba, this run from McIlroy. And we're going to see it next week, too. It's a very similar tournament in California. So again, these guys are getting like really good preparation in under their belts going into the Masters. Four rounds on tough courses with stiff competition is it's what these guys want. And it's unfortunate. We,
Dustin Johnson actually tested positive for COVID-19 before this week. He was the betting favorite going into this week and world number one. So that's someone who is licking his chops that is at a good chance at winning the green jacket, and he might not have a chance to really prepare for the event.
You know, you talk about next week, the Zozo Championship, and Tiger's going to be in the field. And honestly, it's been a disaster of a 2020 for him. You know, you have to caveat of the shutdown and what kind of effect that had. But since he finished T9 at the Farmers back in January, you know, his best finish, I think, is a third tied for 37th at the PGA. He just missed the cut at the U.S. Open in his last start. He hasn't played a ton. I know he won the Zozo last year, but it was in Japan. He has history at the course next week in Southern California. But I guess, what are some expectations on where his game might be? And, you know, he's always played well at Augusta because he loves it there. But do you need to see a good week, good four rounds put together for you to look at him as anything other than just, you know, in the field at Augusta and you know, not remotely a threat?
Yeah, my expectations for Tiger are almost like on a roller coaster. I get really excited about him if I see, you know, one good round of ball striking, or he looks really healthy with his swing or whatever. But next week I will be watching for, yeah, like I said, his swing. Does he look healthy? Does he look fit? Is it that same Tiger, you know, precision we see with his iron play? Is he not missing too many fairways? And then the major letdown for him this season actually was his putter. Like, for some reason, he couldn't find a putting stroke that felt good for him. He was tinkering with his putter a little bit, trying a longer putter to help preserve his back. So if he comes out and, you know, has a few good rounds with the flat stick, then I think there's a chance. You know, he's going to be using it as preparation, obviously, for the Masters. But those would be some encouraging signs if he is rolling the rock a little bit better and just looks overall healthy. I think those would be some positives heading into Augusta.
Erica, one more before I let you go, and it's a topic Josh and I are going to talk about a little bit more rest of the show. PGA Tour added betting odds to the leaderboard the other day, and we're seeing this now. We're seeing, you know, teams welcoming sports gambling, and they've always had a arm's distance relationship, of course, and especially the NFL, which thrives on its gambling presence. Do you see that coming up in golf to a point where, you know, people are thinking, especially now during COVID and you're looking for different ways of making revenue, that this becomes more of the conversation, that we start seeing even guys who are doing play-by-play, whether it's golf or any other sport, actually bringing up, well, you know what, the odds of him making this putt and then birdieing again on 18 would be, are we going to see that, do you think, in golf? Is this just a sign of things to come, or is this just a small little thing that may go nowhere?
I'm extremely bullish on the idea of sports betting in the golf world specifically. That is where I'll keep my focus, because I think it's just such a natural fit. There's so many variables. It's not just a head-to-head matchup, say, in a football game or a basketball game. There's so many different guys at the top of the leaderboard with different odds, and there's so many ways to look at it. You can, you know, this week I've been paying attention to the broadcast to see actually how they integrated the odds. And I thought so far they've done a really good job. They're actually running it parallel with the leaderboard. They'll show everyone's scores and then they'll show their live betting odds, which I wasn't sure how they were going to do it. But if that's the route they want to take, it makes a lot of sense. And it should draw extra eyeballs or interest in the sporting world from, you know, outside sports bettors. Say you bet on football or basketball. And there's, like, you know, there's a PGA tournament finishing on Sunday and there's odds to bet on it. I think it will draw a little more interest to the sport, a little more revenue, like you said, for states or hopefully provinces one day looking to add a little extra revenue. I think golf betting specifically is here to stay, and I'm encouraged so far with how they're integrating it into the broadcast, for sure.
Will be interesting indeed. Eric Patterson has golf coverage at The Score and The Score app joining us here. Talk about the CJ Cup, which continues into round three. Eric, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg with you. Josh, do you think we see anytime in the next year or two start to see the integration. So, for instance, let's say, no matter what the sport, that instead of the third man in the booth or the sideline reporter, we're going to start to see more direct reference and coverage of the sports gambling perspective, not just of golf, but of sports in general. Is it going to be even more mainstream, if I can use that term?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think we're already sort of trending in that direction. You're seeing it on certain broadcasts and, you know, live odds and before a game, who's favored to win, and then maybe some props and stuff like that. And I think it's only trending more in a direction where you might have, like, maybe before the game or during the game, you just have it on a ticker or something like that. Like, just you see a live odds if somebody's partnered, if it's a particular sports book partnered with a particular league or network or whatever it is, however you figure that out. I think it's only a matter of time before you get at the very least that. And then, yeah, maybe there is sideline reports, but in addition to that, there are gambling reports, right, in terms of how much money is on a certain team, how much respective book has to win or lose based on a result. I think, no question, within, you know, certainly the next 2 years, but even sooner, next few months, if not a year, I think we'll start to see more and more of that across all of the major sports.
I totally agree, but do you see any kind of danger at all involved in this, or is this just a natural progression? It doesn't matter. It's not going to affect anything. It's already, you know, we see, you follow social media, and if an NBA team is up by 11 in a game that means nothing, but the line is 8, and they give up a 3-pointer, people are screaming that, well, how do they even take that? You know what I'm saying, Josh, in terms of how it starts to web into it? I don't have any problem with it. I don't bet on sports because I just don't care. I don't need to bet on sports for my involvement and like of sports. But I see it. I understand it. But I think, you know, with the ravages of COVID and where the leagues are going, I think it's a two-pronged thing. We're going to see an enormous increase in gambling being part of the broadcast, along with an encouragement trying to get people to spend money on it, where the teams become now partners with this organization. In other words, sharing in the revenue. And I think it's only a matter of time before you see sponsorship on jerseys, because that's one thing that's also untapped in North America. You see it in Europe all the time. Why not in baseball and hockey and football to more higher extent? I have no problem. The advertising on jerseys doesn't affect the game. I certainly hope it doesn't come to the point, though, that the game becomes, even when the Dodgers are winning 15-5, if the line in the fifth inning was that they weren't getting any closer than 6 runs, you know what I'm saying?
I think that's absolutely, you know, a concern, is that does it take away some of just the pure watching of the game for some people? I guess maybe some people will just be able to separate it and not really be connected to it. And I guess the other thing is, you know, if you're a casual fan and fantasy or gambling hooks you in even more, then I think that that's just something that should be embraced. It's something that now is happening and has been happening for years and years and is clearly a part of mainstream sports. And instead of, I guess, just looking at it from an archaic sense of maybe it poisons the well a little bit or clouds or overshadows what's actually going on, I think it brings in more people to you know, watching sports, going to sports, etc., being involved in respective sports. And if anything, gambling, fantasy will just lead you to, I think, overall start enjoying the sport that you're gambling and doing fantasy with. So I don't really see a ton of downside to it, at least from my vantage point.
I hope you're right. I'll leave it at that. I hope you're right about that. Josh Goldberg, Roger Lajoie. Sportsnet Tonight continues in a moment right here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Radio Network, Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg. One more hour to go with you, and we're going to help you get ready for the American League Championship Series, Game 7, Tampa Bay Rays, Houston Astros. Pre-game starts at 8 o'clock. First pitch just after 8:30. Can the Astros come back and create history? Josh, on their birthday, we should say happy birthday to the Houston Astros, because 60 years ago today, the franchise was formed. as the Houston Colt 45s, which eventually became the Houston Astros. Maybe that'll bring him a little luck tonight.
Little symmetry, yeah. It seems almost destined in a way, but at the same time, you look at their recent history. Outside of Astros fans, do you think anyone is pulling for them? Do you think there are some people who want to see history, or people want to see the Astros come close to making history and then fall flat on their face so everyone can, you know, rub their nose in it?
Nobody is cheering for the Houston Astros, including me, but I will say this. Up until the depths of that cheating scandal was done, all right, I will give them this. Here's the caveat coming. A lot of teams cheat. A lot of teams have cheated. A lot of teams don't even care if the other team's cheating because they're cheating too and they kind of expect it. They just took it to another obscene level where the cheating superseded even the gamesmanship that you do see. But stealing signs, trying to find ways, getting the advantage. I remember asking John Gibbons about that once years ago, and he even kind of chuckled, and he said, well, you know, you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. Like, that's been the kind, and I'm not defending it. I'm not defending it at all. But they took it to another level. And I will put the second caveat. Before that happened, I really liked them. I loved Jose Altuve. He's one of my favorite players. Like a young guy, small, short, but bruiser, fought all the way down. They were always playing the Yankees or Red Sox, and who likes them? So it's like, you know, I liked the Astros until then. But am I cheering for them now? No, because of what happened. Well, that's what makes it especially bad. Listen, if the Yankees or the Red Sox or even the Dodgers, one of the big market, big spending teams, had been caught in the cheating scandal, I'd feel differently than I do about the Houston Astros, because I liked the Astros before all this happened. But to answer your question, no, nobody's cheering for them.
Yeah, I agree also. I like the way that, in theory, the Astros had built a great homegrown team and gone on to win a World Series, and it was encouraging to see it from the perspective of, well, the Jays have a lot of homegrown talent. Maybe they can follow this model. You know, they still have a lot of talent, but even if they are to make it to the World Series and win it this year, everyone will just say, well, they finished below 500. They're the one team that you'll hear people try and slap an asterisk on the World Series if they win it. Anyone else, you know, it's COVID. We made the best of a bad situation. You're a deserving champion. The Astros, no chance. Outside of their fan base, everyone will be saying, well, it's a 60-game expanded playoffs. You guys finished below 500. You're a paper champion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that's a fair amount. I think we're going to get a little tiny bit of that regardless of baseball, because it was only a 60-game regular season. The NHL and the NBA had their regular playoffs and 90% of their regular seasons. Can't say the same thing for baseball, but we shall see. Game 7 is always fun. It's coming up. Dodgers up 3-0 on the Braves still. Top of the 7th. Runner at 3rd and 1 out for the Braves. Let's see if they can come back. We'll keep you up to date. And lots of pregame coverage is still to come here as Sportsnet Tonight continues with Roger Lajoie, Josh Goldberg on the Sportsnet Radio Network.